How are y'all doing this morning? Awesome. As Carrie said, I'll be speaking this afternoon on sleep disorders and sleep problems, and then on Saturday doing the whole thing over again, so doing the morning on TMD and the afternoon on sleep. So if I go too fast, you can come back and hear me again on Saturday. If you aren't planning on coming to the sleep lecture, I would put a nice plug in for that. You will, by the end of this lecture, you will recognize that there's a major correlation between sleep problems and TMJ problems. Okay, and I'll kind of talk you through some of my pathway in figuring that out and how that has changed my practice over the years. So allow me to introduce myself a little bit. So I, as Carrie said, I'm from Boise, Idaho. I always put this in here first in my lecture, mostly because I speak a lot on the East Coast and they have no clue where Idaho is. A lot of Californians know where Idaho is because most Californians live in Idaho now, I think. At least that's our perspective as being an Idahoan, that everyone from California moves there. One little piece of trivia for you, though, is Boise is actually ever so slightly west of San Diego. Okay, and we're in the mountain time zone, so again, for you, like you golfers and stuff like that, it doesn't get dark till about 10:30 in Boise in the summer. It's kind of nice. We're out on our boat till 10:30, 11 o'clock, and still golfing at that time, so it's a nice place to be. This is my family, the wife there and the six kids. These guys who look similar, they're twins. They were born second year of dental school, which doesn't mean anything about me, but means a lot about my wife, or means she's a pretty strong woman there to be basically a single mother with three kids while I was in dental school, waxing up crowns and stuff like that and things like that. Which one's the wife? This one here. And I actually brought my redheaded daughter and my redheaded son, so it's the three gingers are here together. They're playing around at the beach today. What is making that noise? Oh, that's not lying. Carrie, I think this is your phone up here, and you're getting lots of text messages. So there we are at Lake Powell. Probably a lot of you have been there. For you skiers, this is just north of Boise a couple hours. This is me skiing. This is my glove and a pole and my glove, and that's a heck of a lot of powder snow right there. It doesn't happen every year, unfortunately, but that was a day, actually, I took off from work. You know, was sick that day or whatever. Figured if people couldn't come in because of the snow on the roads, I could go skiing, and that was one of the best days of my life, actually. This is our center in Boise and in Colorado, but just changed the name. So you see here, it's Craniofacial Pain Center of Idaho, TMJ disorders, blah, blah, blah. We just changed our name to the Center for Sleep Apnea and TMJ. Why that was, I was kind of one of the guys that was passionate about, you know, we shouldn't use the term TMJ. You know, what does that mean? That's like saying you've got knee or you've got shoulder, you know, to say TMJ. And after realizing that every medical doctor in my community called it TMJ, that the neurosurgeons, when they would refer people to me, it's like, yeah, Jameson, this person's got TMJ. I'm like, you know what? To hell with it. I'm calling it TMJ. If all these people that are way smarter than me call it TMJ, I'll just call it TMJ, I guess. So now we've called it the Center for Sleep Apnea and TMJ. And the reason sleep apnea is first is because I think sleep apnea is oftentimes driving these problems quite a bit, which again we'll talk about a lot this afternoon, but we'll talk about that this morning as well. I'm adjunct at Boise State and at Tufts. Those are rather disparate, you know, locations there from Boise to Boston, but did a master's at Tufts University. For those of you who are interested in learning more about this stuff, particularly on sleep, I've got a thing up here. If you'd like to come to Boise, you can come and get this later. Tufts, we also have a mini residency in dental sleep medicine, multi-days, like 9 days over a year's period of time, where you learn about that. This lecture, I am 99% sure, is being recorded. Submitted my slides to them, so I think you can buy it or something. Maybe you just get it. I don't know. I don't know if you can download those slides. However, what I will offer you is at the end, or I'll give you like a 3-minute stretch break about halfway through my lecture here. I've got some things up here. It says on here dentist role in sleep apnea, but you could just like cross that out and put TMD, or I'll send you both. You could put your information on here or just drop off a business card up here on the desk, and I will send you the slides from this lecture. Okay? So having said that, I would still like you to take notes, if you don't mind. So if you take notes, and this goes a little bit into my sleep stuff, if you take notes when you go to sleep tonight and go into REM sleep, your brain will decide that the things that you wrote down on the paper are things you should keep. Okay, there's all sorts of stuff today that you're going to have stimulus of that your brain is going to decide is not necessary to keep. How light the room was, the sound of that projector, what color my tie was. You know, all this stuff is going to go away. But all the stuff that's important will go away too, unless you kind of give your brain a clue that maybe you should remember that. Okay? But you can also get the slides and view this at some other time if you want. All right. So we're going to start off with a head and neck anatomy review. Why in the world would I start a lecture on TMJ problems with anatomy? Go ahead and tell me. Yes? Because I'm the boss. Okay, so I can do whatever I want. So I could start it with whatever. Good call. Why else? What might be a practical reason for that? Okay.
Identify what muscles are affecting the problem.
Yeah, so we can identify what muscles are affecting the problem, things like that. It's all about the anatomy. It's all about the anatomy from my perspective. Okay, so let me give you a little preview here of the next 2.5 hours. I'm a structuralist. I look for structure-related stuff that's driving the etiology of these problems. If you came here today to learn about the latest drugs to treat TMJ problems, you are in the wrong place. Okay, I will be talking 3 sentences about drugs. Because that's not what I do. Okay, I kind of figured this out the other day of maybe why that is a little bit. You know, in medicine, in medical doctors, our medical colleagues, there's the term medicine and surgery, right? There's people that are in medicine, and there's those who are in surgery. And what's the difference between those groups? Those in medicine tend to give medicine. So they give drugs, right? They figure out a problem, they give drugs for it. Those in surgery tend to do what? Cut stuff out. And what are we as dentists? We're kind of both. But we definitely lean more towards the surgery side, don't we? We find things wrong and we fix it, often surgically. DDS, Doctor of Dental Surgery, I'm a DMD, but whatever. So we are surgeons, and so this will probably appeal to you a little bit more than if I was to stand up here and talk about drugs for 2.5 hours. Okay, because I'm going to talk about structure and why it does what it does and what's going on and how you can take care of it structurally. Okay, so there's a little preview. Okay, I'm going to take one more question, and then you're banned. You're done.
You going to include Janet Trevell's work?
Absolutely, if I have time. So the question was, am I going to include Janet Trevell's work with myofascial pain? That's sort of my bonus. So if you don't ask me too many questions, I might get to that, but normally I don't. So we have 2.5 hours. Normally I like 3 hours to give this lecture. However, if I send you the slides or you just get it, it's on there. Your wife says you talk too much, huh? So, by the way, too, if you're coming for the sleep lecture this afternoon, how many are planning on that? You better come early, because this is about the fullest room I've seen for a TMD lecture. Okay? TMD is like, so boring. So you guys must have heard something about how awesome I am, or you wouldn't even be here. So that's good. Thank you. But for the sleep lecture, the first time I came to CDA was in a room twice this big, and 45 minutes before my lecture started, it was full. And I thought there was going to be fist fights. There were people that had come in and put a bag down and then left to get a coffee or something. And someone took their bag and put it out in the aisle and sat down in their spot. So they're like, you can't save a seat. And I thought there was going to literally be fist fights and stuff. But anyway, so heads up if you're coming for the sleep lecture. So let's do some anatomy. Oh, by the way, I'm a humanities major too in college. So I like to throw some art history in here. So who painted this? Rembrandt, very good. You guys are good. All right, so let's go back to some embryology, where it all began. Now, believe it or not, this is all in your brain somewhere. You learn this in dental school. This is in there. Dental school, hygiene school, this is in there. So remember our gastrula. We have this bilaminar embryonic disc here. We have our endoderm and the mesoderm. We have mesenchymal differentiation, and all of our tissues come from this stuff. So we're going to talk about our ectoderm, mesoderm, and endoderm, and what is derived from that. So with our ectoderm, we get this from the epiblast layer. From the ectoderm comes our nervous system, our entire central nervous system. Sensory epithelium of the eye, ear, and nose, the epidermis, hair, and nails, mammary and cutaneous glands, epithelium of the sinus, oral, and nasal cavities. Tooth enamel comes from the ectoderm. Now, that might be kind of interesting right there for you, that the nervous system, the central nervous system, and the tooth enamel come from the same embryologic tissue. Anyone in here study any acupuncture, by any chance? You again? You're kidding me. Anybody else? 20 years ago? It hasn't changed. 45, don't care. It's 5,000-year-old practice. It's been around. So the reason I bring up acupuncture is all the acupuncture meridians go through the teeth. Okay, they all go through the teeth. So who knows? Maybe there is some sort of correlation here because of embryology. Okay, I'm going to come back to this all the time of how it was formed, where it came from. So there's just one little clue there that's interesting, that tooth enamel and the nervous system come from the same stuff. Mesoderm, we got our muscles, connective tissue derivatives. So this is bone, cartilage, and all the inside part of the tooth. So outside of the tooth, different embryological structure than the inside of the tooth. Endoderm is all of our inside stuff, gastrointestinal tract, epithelium, associated glands. You remember the branchial arches. So these are the little gill things that make us look like a tadpole when we're at this stage. At this stage, we are entirely nose. Some of us kind of stay that way in life, but are all nose here. Got a little eye, which is interesting. But these are our branchial arches down in here, and we have different things forming from these. So our first branchial arch, we get our trigeminal nerve, muscles of mastication, mylohyoid muscle, anterior belly digastric muscle, tensor tympani, tensor belly palatini, malleus and incus, the little bones in our ear, anterior ligament of the malleus, sphenomandibular ligament, portion of the sphenobone, lower lip, lower face, and the mandible. This is associated with Meckel's cartilage. I didn't understand exactly what that meant in dental school, Meckel's cartilage, or what that did. I thought it like all came from it. Meckel's cartilage is like as a scaffolding is to the building of a building, so is Meckel's cartilage to the formation of these structures. All right, so it's just kind of there as a substructure to help create these things. Our second or hyoid arch, we get our facial nerve, stapedius muscle, muscles of facial expression, posterior belly digastric, and the stylohyoid. Now, if I go back two slides, if you don't mind, what nerve do you think innervates the muscles of mastication? The trigeminal nerve. Why? Because embryologically, they come from the same place. All right, so the muscles of mastication are innervated by the trigeminal nerve. What nerve do you think innervates the anterior belly digastric? The trigeminal nerve, okay? The tensor tympani, tensor belly palatini. Does that make sense? So embryologically, they're all coming from the same stuff. What nerve do you think innervates the muscles of facial expression? The facial nerve, right? So start to kind of play these things together. That's why the facial nerve innervates the muscles of facial expression. That's why the trigeminal nerve innervates the muscles of mastication, because they came from the same embryologic tissues. Okay, moving on. Our third arch, we get our glossopharyngeal nerve, so down in the neck a little bit more, stylopharyngeal muscle, greater corner of the hyoid, lower portion of the body of the hyoid, and then farther down yet, we get our superior laryngeal branch, the recurrent laryngeal branch of the vagus nerve, and some muscles there too. Okay, so some osteology. I love this Netter drawing because it shows soft tissue. This is all soft tissue here and cartilage. And then our bone forms by plate formation around that soft tissue. So the soft tissue is there first, and then the bone forms around the soft tissue. Okay? So in a second, I'll talk about different foramina and stuff like that. So foramen ovale, for example, is oval because that branch of the trigeminal nerve is oval. And so the bone formed around it and is oval in nature because of that. Does that make sense? So the soft tissue's there, the bone forms around it. Here we go to our infantile skull, and this is the difference between the infantile and the adult skull. What is the major difference between this skull and that skull? What? The mid face and lower face, right? This part. This is really nothing there, and then we have this growth here. Some of this growth and development that occurs from here to here may result in problems if that growth and development is not ideal. So we could have some retronathia that could cause jaw problems, sleep apnea problems, things like that. These are things that we as dentists sometimes can evaluate and intercede quickly and start helping these problems when before they really become a problem. Okay. I'll talk more about this in the sleep apnea lecture, but the redheaded boy who just turned 9, he's had a sleep study and his tonsils out. My 6-year-old is having a sleep study on Saturday because I was on a camp out with him recently and noticed that he snored. Okay. So not necessarily super retronathic or stuff like that, but there's some things going on that I want tested and taken care of before it becomes a problem. All right, so what we're going to do is I'm going to go over some of these bones, and then this is going to be our interactive portion where I'm going to ask you what the bone is. So remember these bones that I go over really quick. So the cranial bones, these bones here are the occipital bones, frontal, parietal, temporal, sphenoid, and ethmoid. Vomer, lacrimal, nasal, inferior nasal conches, zygomatic, maxillary, and mandible. Okay, our brain is in this space here. Again, the bone forms around the soft tissue of the brain. We have our nerves coming through those foramina. Some more art history. Who painted this? Michelangelo, right? Where is this? Sistine Chapel. Have any of you seen it in person? Right on. So for those of you who have not seen it in person and you're planning a trip to Rome, if you go to Rome, don't do what I did and go to Rome on Sunday. Okay, why? Well, not only because there's a whole boatload of people there, but this is closed. Except I think there's one Sunday a month that it's open, and I was not there on either of the two Sundays that I've been in Rome. I was not there when this was open. So I've been able to climb up to St. Peter's Basilica, climb up in the dome, that's pretty cool, look out over Rome, look on the roof of the Sistine Chapel. And maybe Michelangelo painted the roof. I don't know. If he did, it's just red. It's not that exciting. But I didn't get to see this, so I'm bummed about that. But anyway, I wrote a paper about this in college. Does this shape look familiar? Here's the pituitary gland right there. Does that shape look familiar? So I didn't come up with this idea on my own. I just wrote a research paper on it. Some medical doctors came up with this idea that Michelangelo used this shape around God to indicate that God was giving Adam knowledge instead of life. And that's why Adam's eyes are open. So that's kind of fun. All right, here we go. So I'm going to point at a bone, and you're going to say what it is. All right? There's several hundred people in the room, so this should be quite exciting. All right, so say it out loud. Okay, ready? This is the? Okay, you can do better than that. Okay, this is the? There you go, thank you. This is the? Close. Frontal. I always get a resounding frontal, and then I get a, I'm not sure what that one is. Okay, this is parietal. Good. This is occipital. Awesome. This is? Good. This one? Who knows? Sphenoid. Very good. This one? Close. Zygomatic. Okay, everybody get ready. This is your time to shine. Everyone get ready. Get ready. This one here? Mandible. Awesome. If you don't know that one, just leave. Okay? You have no hope. Okay? I can't help you. All right, this one? Maxillary. Excellent. This? Did someone say occipital? Occipital's way back here. Well, we're getting a lot of activity, so that's good. That's the lacrimal, ethmoid, and nasal. It'll show better on this slide here. Okay, let's do it again. This one? Frontal. This one? Parietal. This one? Occipital. This one? Temporal, this one. Mandible, this one. Sphenoid, very good. This. Nasal, this. Maxilla, this. Lacrimal, that guy. Ethmoid, that's hard for me to hold it still. That one. Ethmoid. This one. Zygomatic, very good. Let's do it from the front. This one. Frontal, this one. Zygomatic. This one, now check it out. It's the same color out here. Sphenoid. Sphenoid bone, right? This one. Maxilla. This one. Lacrimal. Okay, now look at this one. It's here, and it's also there and there. That's the ethmoid. So the ethmoid bone is this crazy bone. This is called the perpendicular plate of the ethmoid bone. We're going to see that in a minute, too, up at the top, up where the brain sits, called the crista galli. So the ethmoid bone is here, perpendicular plate. This perpendicular plate of the ethmoid bone, and the what bone is this? We haven't mentioned that one yet. Someone saying over here. What? Vomer, very good. So this is the vomer. This is the vomer. So the vomer and the perpendicular plate of the ethmoid bone make up the Septum, yeah, the nasal septum. Okay. So, I'm sorry?
Stalactites.
Stalactites, yes, it's a stalactite that comes down. So this is the nasal septum. Those two bones come together. My kind of standing joke is with any of my ear, nose, and throat doctor friends, if they ever need to make a boat payment or something, they can always say that the next five people that walk in have a deviated septum. Because dang near everybody on earth has a deviated septum to one side or another, you know, to just a little bit. So that's what makes up our septum. We have our middle concha and the superior concha are part of the ethmoid bone. Based on that, what do you think this is? That's the inferior nasal concha, which is its own bone. Okay, it's its own bone. It's not related to the maxilla or the ethmoid. It's its own thing.
Doctor.
Yes, sir.
Do the turbinates go over those bones?
The turbinates go over these bones. That's correct. So when they do a turbinate reduction surgery, they will go in and kind of grind that up and then get rid of the soft tissue as well. Yeah. Sometimes they'll go and break these off. There's various ways that they'll treat that.
The turbinates bone or soft tissue?
The turbinates themselves are bone, and then the tissue is over it, and it is a erectile tissue, so it swells. So that's your, if all of you breathe through your nose, you may find right now that one side you're breathing more through than the other side is fairly typical, and you're on a rhythm. So about every hour to hour and a half, you switch sides of breathing more through one nostril than the other. And that's because breathing through your nose moistens the air, causes some turbulence there. That's where the turbinate comes from and is more satisfying to breathe through your nose. There's other positive reasons about breathing through your nose, but those tissues will kind of swell so that it kind of shuts down flow on one side, opens it up on the other side, and then it will switch back and forth on purpose. All right, bony openings of the skull. So here's the stuff that goes through these openings in the skull. Some of these I'll talk about specifically, but we have our foramen cecum for the emissary vein, the cribriform plate where our olfactory bulb sits for our sense of smell, optic canal for the optic nerve, superior orbital fissure for the oculomotor nerve 3, trochlear nerve 4, so these are cranial nerve 3 and 4, ophthalmic division of the trigeminal nerve. So whenever I refer to trigeminal nerve stuff, I will say V as in Roman numeral 5. V1, V2, V3. So the ophthalmic nerve is V1. Abducens nerve is cranial nerve 6. Rotundum for the maxillary division of the trigeminal nerve, or V2. Ovale for the mandibular division, V3. Spinosum for the meningeal branch of V3. I'm going to come back to that in a second. Remember that I just said that. Meningeal branch of V3, spinosum. Foramen lacerum, greater petrosal nerve, carotid canal for the internal carotid artery, internal acoustic meatus for the facial nerve, vestibular cochlear nerve, jugular foramen for the glossopharyngeal nerve 9, vagus 10, and accessory nerve 11, and hypoglossal canal for hypoglossal nerve 12. All right, so here we are looking down. This is our ethmoid bone at the top. Okay, that's the crista galli. Our olfactory bulbs sit on both sides of that, go down through those little holes called the cribriform plate, and that's for our sense of smell, which is the top part there. Okay? Here's our sphenoid bone that we talked about, and optic nerve here. And for our trigeminal nerve, we have rotundum, which is round, so that's V2. V1 goes through here, and V3 is ovale. All right. Now, I'm from Idaho, so we have a lot of cowboys in Idaho, so let me teach you a cowboy story to remember these holes, because this is really important. If you don't understand these holes, there's no way in hell you can treat TMJ problems. Thank you for the laugh over there. So that's a little bit not so true. I mean, if you should know it, I guess, but if you forget where spinosum is, that's not gonna make a difference in diagnosing a capsulitis, which I'm gonna talk about in a minute. But anyway, you may just wanna know this just to make yourself feel smart. So this is, what's this area called here? Sella Turska, which means?
Turkish
saddle, very good. So a Turkish saddle has a backrest. So cowboy sitting in a saddle, he looks out through the optic foramen. That makes sense. And he needs to get his cows rounded up, rotundum, and out to the old valley, ovale. So he digs in his spurs, spinosum, and next to his saddle, like every good cowboy, he has his lasso lacerum. Good? Okay, this one looks like a big J. Which foramen do you think that is? I'll give you a hint. It has something to do with a big J. Jugular, good. So that's the jugular foramen. And then this one, our favorite, is the foramen? Magnum, very good. All right, so this one's spinosum. Okay, once again, V1. So I'm talking trigeminal nerve a lot because that's our nerve, right? That's the nerve that we deal with, trigeminal nerve. So V1's up here. V2, maxillary nerve, rotundum. V3, ovale, right there. Okay, that's spinosum. What did I say goes through spinosum? I told you to remember it. Meningeal branch of V3. Okay, think that through. Meningeal branch of V3. V3 is the mandibular branch, mandibular nerve. So, is the nerve going, and excuse that this is actually contextually wrong, that what I'm about to say, but is the nerve going up that hole or out that hole? Think about it. It's the meningeal branch. It's coming up the hole, okay? So the V3, the mandibular nerve that goes to our lower jaw, goes out that hole, so to speak. The reason I'm saying that's wrong is because the soft tissue is there and the bone forms around it, right? So we're all cool with that? I'm still going to say out and in just for fun. So it goes out ovale and then on its way down to our mandible and stuff. It gives off a branch called the meningeal branch, which goes up spinosum and innervates what? It innervates the foot. What do you think it innervates? The meninges, very good. Okay, I have to ask questions like that because people are like, I don't know. Innervates the meninges. What are the meninges? The covering of the brain, right? Okay, so just theoretically, is it possible that there could be a clinical correlation with jaw things and headaches? There could be, huh? Did someone say no? There can be. Okay, the other meninges are innervated by the maxillary nerve. I just don't get to talk about it as much because there's not a hole for it. You could do a filling and someone could have headaches afterwards because of the anatomical wiring. All right? I talk a lot about wiring. One of my favorite analogies that I use with my patients too is, do any of you have GFI switches, ground fault interrupter switches in your house? You have a house that was built after 1975 or something like that? Okay, what do those things do? They're usually by water. They're usually in your kitchen. They're in your bathroom, stuff like that. So they're on the receptacle. There's a little bar there, right? And that's a breaker at the plug. Okay? Have any of you ever had one of those pop and it was related to wires a long ways away from that place? Like, I think sometimes electricians, when they're building houses, do things just to screw with you. Because I had a house that we built that the garage door openers were connected to a GFI switch in like a laundry room. So if there was something there, it would pop that, and then your garage door opener doesn't work. You're like, what the heck is going on? Okay, and so you search it. So let me go through this. And for some of you, will know what I'm talking about. Others of you, just call an electrician if a light's not working. But let's say that you went to open your garage door and it didn't work. What would you do? Where would you go first? The breaker box, right? Yeah, you go to the breaker box, open it up, you look at it all, nothing's popped. Then what do? Then you start checking GFIs through the whole freaking house because you don't know which one is associated with that. Okay, and eventually you find it and then it works. Now, then you make a note. It's like, okay, something wrong in the garage. That is related to GFI switch in the kitchen. Okay, what am I talking about? So with TMJ stuff, with facial pain problems, it's wiring. If somebody comes in and they're having pain in their face someplace, it will make sense with the wiring. At your house, it's never going to be that your neighbor's GFI switch popped and your garage door doesn't open. Does that make sense? So people, it will always make sense anatomically. One of the best things about facial pain problems is these nerves don't cross the midline. So people rarely have pain across the midline because it's this side and it's this side. Even if they say my whole face hurts, they will almost always say one side's worse. And if you treat sort of the one side, like I give them a shot and turn off the pain on one side, the other side won't hurt either because it was just sort of sympathy pain. This stuff always makes sense electrically, always. If it doesn't, then you punt, then you get rid of it because it should always make sense. All right, I cover enough of those? I think so. All right, here's our maxilla. What's this one? Incisive. This is? Greater palatine. All right. So facial nerve has the longest travel through bone, goes in I've never blanked on this before. I'll come back to that, I guess. What's the foramen that goes through in the ear? I'm blanking on it. Anyone help me? Killing me here. Through Fred's foramen, as far as you know. What's that? No, stylomastoid's where it comes out. Comes out stylomastoid, goes through the... Oh, I'm killing myself here. Anyway, I'll come back to that. I've never forgotten that in my life. So it goes into the bone here with the nerve that goes into the ear and all those other nerves. Goes through bone. Now, it's not going through bone, though, is it? It is covered with lots of bone here. Lots of bone. And it gives off a branch that is also covered by bone. And this branch, can you read this? It's called the corda tympani. What does that do? Does anyone remember? So this is facial nerve. Corda tympani innervates the tympanic membrane, and then where does it go? Corda tympani, it goes to the cords? No. No. Has something to, yes, who said that? Very good, thank you very much. So the corda tympani joins the lingual nerve. The lingual nerve is a branch of V3. So the mandibular nerve, lingual nerve go together. So the corda tympani joins the lingual nerve and goes to the tongue, and gives us our special sense of taste. So to touch the tongue is V3. To taste something off your finger is facial nerve. Facial nerve through this special wiring. Why is it wired that way? I don't know, but it's pretty cool. Stylomastoid foramen. Here's the styloid process. Here's the mastoid process. Stylomastoid foramen. So that's where the facial nerve comes out. The facial nerve goes through this thing here. What's this thing here called? Parotid. Yeah, that's the parotid gland. So the parotid gland, which is one of our salivary glands, and the facial nerve goes through the parotid gland. Now we have branches of the facial nerve. Okay. The way I remember that is two zebras bought my car. Two zebras bought my car. So temporal, zygomatic, bought, buckle, my, marginal mandibular, car, cervical. So those are the branches of the facial nerve. Facial nerve, other than what we just talked about, was taste, which hitches a ride with the lingual nerve. Facial nerve is all motor. Muscles of facial expression. Okay? And that's it. So if you touch your face, that is not facial nerve. If someone has facial pain, that's not facial nerve. If someone had a facial nerve problem, how would you notice that? Paralysis. It would be Bell's palsy. Okay? That would be facial nerve. So we don't deal much with that. I'll get dentists to call me. I'm like, hey, James, I'm sending this patient over. I think they got a facial nerve problem. I go, crud. That's Bell's palsy. That's not really something I deal with. And then they'll say, yeah, they've got a lot of pain in their face. I'm like, oh, okay. That's not facial nerve. Okay? Pain in the face is trigeminal nerve. Make sense? What's that? Stylomastoid foramen is that one right there. Yep. Are you thinking of the one that goes in?
Facial nerve.
Yes, facial nerve comes out the stylomastoid foramen. I'm still thinking of the gosh dang nerve that it goes into in the inside of the head. Just driving me crazy, which is right there. It'll come to me. Don't worry. So sphenoid bone, we have all our holes for the trigeminal nerve. Ophthalmic division is purely sensory, so that's just touch on your forehead. Maxillary division we deal with all the time, right? So the maxillary division goes to our maxillary teeth. We have this loop here. So we have our posterior superalveolar. Some people have a middle superalveolar. And then we have our anterior superalveolar. And this loop goes to our maxillary teeth. We can access this through our greater palatine foramen. Do any of you do that? You give a shot up the greater palatine foramen to block the maxillary nerve? Seriously, no one in the whole room? Okay, there we go. 3, 4, 5. Infrequently. No, you didn't say accidentally, did you? Someone did. So if you go up the greater palatine foramen, your needle will end up right there. By the way, this is in Stan's textbook, Stanley Malamud's textbook. I don't make this stuff up. So there's ways to block the maxillary nerve. That would be helpful if you're doing a full arch case. I've found in my travels that more hygienists know how to do this than dentists, because some hygienists are taught how to do this in hygiene school because they're always working in a full quadrant, right? So needle up, greater palatine foramen, it ends up right there. You have no choice to be on V2 for a block. So you might consider doing that if you do a lot of big cases. All right, so here we have V1 again, V2, and V3. So this is the mandibular or the inferior alveolar nerve. What's this one here? We talked about it a second ago. Lingual nerve, okay? So it's the lingual nerve. So when you give an inferior alveolar nerve block and the tongue gets numb, but the teeth don't, that's because you were either too low or too medial. Okay? Too medial. So here we have our inferior alveolar nerve, and it goes into the mandibular canal, comes through. What's this nerve here called? Mental nerve. If we were to anesthetize the front teeth, what would we call that? Ooh, you're good. What would we call it? Don't listen to him. A mental block. Yeah, which is what I have right now with the freaking acoustic. Internal acoustic meatus. Ah!
Yay.
Holy crap, it was killing me. Internal acoustic meatus, that's what it's called. So, a mental block. Now, you were right. So, mental block is what everybody else calls this, and it's wrong. So, you said the incisive block. So, the mental nerve is here. If we were to block the mental nerve, what would get numb?
The tissue back there.
The lip? No, not teeth. Because this is the mental nerve. Here is incisive. So we all call it, though, that, right? I mean, every dentist on earth calls it that because we stick our needle here and we hope our anesthetic goes through the mental foramen to anesthetize this nerve, which actually has a name. That's called the incisive nerve. So from here on, it's called the incisive nerve. Okay, who cares? That's not going to change your life, is it? But you knew, so this guy is superior to the rest of you. You are in that. All right, here's the jaw. What's this called? This is another test. See if you're in the right place. This is the condyle, right? This is the coronoid process. Good. This is called the lingula. This is where inferior alveolar nerve goes. This is where the floor of the mouth attaches. Mylohyoid ridge. Okay. This, I'll show this in another place too, but you see these little bumps here maybe? And these bumps here. What are those called? Genial tubercles. What attaches to the genial tubercles? Sort of in general. Genial blah, 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 blah. But I'm talking in general terms. Blah, 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 blah. What attaches there? What's another word for that? The tongue. Thank you. I'm trying to be kind of dumb it down here a little bit. Genial glossus. So there's genial glossus, genial hyoid, blah, blah. But the tongue attaches to our chin right here. Okay, so here's the whole, if you don't want to attend my sleep apnea lecture, here's the entire sleep apnea lecture. The tongue attaches to your chin, you bring your jaw forward, it opens the airway. That's how it works. That's our entire contribution to sleep apnea is we bring the jaw forward and open the airway. Duh. That's what you learn when you do CPR, right? Head tilt, chin lift. That's what we do. That's why it works. Is because the tongue is attached to our chin. When we bring the jaw forward, we breathe the tongue out of the airway, we open the airway. Okay? That's important. These are all showing muscle attachments. This is where the masseter attaches, temporalis, lateral pterygoid, muscles of facial expression, medial pterygoid here. All right, so let's talk about some of these muscles. Muscles of facial expression are all innervated by the facial nerve. Why? What? Same stuff, same brachial arch. This is, it all came from the same embryologic tissue. Okay, so that's why the facial nerve innervates the muscles of facial expression. And facial nerve also innervates those other things that came from the exact same embryological tissues. These are our muscles of facial expression. Frontalis, occipitalis, or called epicranial, orbicularis oculi, curvilinear supercilii, orbicularis oris, buccinae, resoris, levator, labi superioris. My personal favorite, levator, labi superioris, aliquot nasi. Okay, say that three or four times fast. If you want to feel smart at some cocktail party or something, just like scratch your nose like this and go, dude, my levator, labi superioris, aliquot nasi is really bothering me today. I don't know what I did. Must have worked out too hard yesterday. Okay. This is also, I call this my Billy Idol muscle. So if you're my age, this is the Billy Idol muscle with the sneering. If you're older than me, it's the Elvis muscle. If you're younger than me, I don't know who does that anymore, you know. Zygomaticus major, minor, levator anglia, oris, bracer anglia, oris, labor inferioris, mentalis, and platysma. Anyone in here treat like a reasonable number of TMJ patients? Okay, a lot of you do. Great. Do you have a lot of patients with facial muscle pain? Everybody always says yes to that. That's a loaded question. No, you don't. Okay, so someone comes in and they're like, it's my zygomaticus major. I'm a cheerleader. I've been doing this all weekend. My zygomaticus major is killing me, doc. No, you will have people that have facial muscle pain. Don't get me wrong. But the vast majority of the problems that we have are muscles of mastication. Okay, our masseter, temporalis, medial pterygoid, lateral pterygoid. Not really our muscles of facial expression. Okay? However, there are trigger points, stuff like that in them. Platysma, okay? Now, interesting, most of you did cadaver dissections, right? In dental school? Did your cadaver look like this? Not even close, right? As a matter of fact, if you had like a zygomaticus major or minor on the cadaver, on someone's cadaver in the room, you cut that freaker off, didn't you? Because you didn't want to get tested on it. You're like, what is that? Oops. You know, and it like disappeared. Did any of you do that? I never did that. And I loved anatomy from the beginning. But the reason why do you think our dissections didn't look like that? So you've probably never thought about this, but the origin of all the muscles of facial expression is the bone of the skull. What's the insertion of all the muscles of facial expression? The skin. The skin of the face. So when you took the skin off, what happened to a lot of those muscles? They came off. Okay, so you had a few left over. Okay, so you didn't have this gorgeous dissection, kind of like this here. But these are muscles of facial expression. Parotid gland, again, facial nerve going through the parotid gland to get to our muscles of facial expression, which is motor. Okay, what muscle's this? It's the inside view. That's kind of a cool view. Buccinator, very good. So buccinator, let's take a vote. Is that a muscle of facial expression or mastication? Okay, so how many vote for buccinator is mastication? Raise your hand. All right, reasonable. How many vote for facial expression? Raise your hand. Okay, how many of you do not have working shoulders? It's always sad in a group of dental professionals that so many people don't have shoulders that work. It's amazing. I only got like 10%. Okay, one more time, everybody involved. Don't worry, there's all sorts of people that raise their hand on, you can't go wrong here. Okay, muscle of facial expression. I'll do it backwards. Okay, ready? Okay, there better be a hell of a lot of you. Oh, raise your hand for mastication then. Ready? Mastication. Yeah. Facial expression. Why is it facial expression? Branchial arches, because that's where it came from. It's a muscle of facial expression. It's not necessarily just what they do, because you say, well, the buccinator helps keep the food between the teeth. Well, my orbicularis oris keeps soup from falling out of my mouth. But I don't call it a muscle of mastication. All right, so buccinator, facial expression.
Because of origin of nerves.
Because of origin, yeah. It's innervated by the facial nerve. It's where it comes from. It is facial expression. This is a little scene from Idaho there. Muscles of mastication. All the muscles of mastication are innervated by the trigeminal nerve. Why? Because they come from the same stuff. All right? So muscles of mastication are all innervated by the trigeminal nerve, as well as these other tissues. Our muscles of mastication are the, what's this? Temporalis, this, masseter, this, medial pterygoid, and the lateral pterygoid, or you can call it external and internal, but medial and lateral are for those in the 21st century and beyond. So temporalis, masseter, medial, and lateral pterygoid. Oh, what was this? That's that buccinator again, right? And this is the turgomandibular raphae, and this muscle here, I'll come back to this in a minute, but this is one of your superior pharyngeal constrictors, one of your throat muscles for swallowing. The buccinator comes back and joins that. We'll talk about that later. All right. Origin insertions of these. Now, remember that all of these, the innervation, it gives a specific nerve if you're looking over these slides later, but all of these are branches of the mandibular division of the trigeminal nerve. All right? All of them. So they have specific names, but it's all mandibular nerve. All right? For all of these, all V3. Lateral pterygoid has two different heads. Has an inferior belly, which attaches to the condyle, and has a superior belly, which attaches to the disc. Okay, and they work opposite each other. I'll show that on a picture in a second. Medial pterygoid. All right, so let's go through this. So we have our temporalis, masseter, medial pterygoid, and lateral pterygoid. The masseter and the medial pterygoid form a sling around the jaw. The masseter, now how do muscles work? What do muscles do? They contract. They do anything else? They feel happy or sad? No, they contract. They shorten. Do they lengthen? Only if they're pulled. Only if they're lengthened. So if I contract, if I shorten my bicep, can I straight? Can I make it like that again, other than using my tricep? No. Muscles contract. That's it. They contract and they relax. They contract and they don't contract. That's all. Can they contract in a fun way? So like in certain, like this muscle here, could it contract in, instead of this vector here, could it contract in that vector? No. It can only pull based on the vector of its fibers. That's it. That's all it can do. All right? So the masseter has a deep segment and a superficial segment, and they have different orientations. So when these fibers contract, it pulls the mandible that way. There's no way other to do it. When these fibers contract, it pulls it that way. All right? Another little thing on muscle physiology. When we contract a muscle, do all the fibers contract? No. They don't, right? So there's muscle fiber recruitment. So if I come over and pick this up, my brain knows approximately how much force to use, how many muscle fibers contract, right? Whereas if I was lifting this, that requires more. This, for those of you in the back row there. Okay. But the muscle fibers that were recruited a second ago, there's these little bundles of muscle fibers, right? In each of those little bundles, how many of the muscle fibers contracted? Who remembers this? You remember something called the all or none principle? So with the little bundles of muscle fibers that were used, all of them within those bundles fired. It's all or none. Okay? So the brain decides how many do I need and fires those, and they fire 100%. They don't fire 80%, they don't fire 50%, they fire 100%, and it contracts. And when the brain decides you need more muscle, then it recruits more of these bundles. Make sense? Okay, why I'm bringing all this up is it has to do with how much force we are doing here. So chewing is different forces depending on what you're chewing. Clenching and grinding your teeth, some people may put tremendous forces and pressure doing that, where some other person may not. Okay, and we'll talk about that more in a second. But so that's just a little muscle physiology, how these things work. Broad origin insertion, one neuron innervates 600 of these fibrils that I'm talking about. Medial pterygoid is on the inside, so this masseter and this medial pterygoid work together, okay? Because our jaw shifts a little bit when we chew, right? To line up the teeth, it shifts a little. So the contralateral medial pterygoid will work with this masseter when we have food between our teeth there.
Doctor, on your last slide, how is the nerve innervation different to trigger which belly is contracted?
How's the nerve innervation?
It's coming from one nerve. Right?
Correct. So the masseteric nerve, and then it has nerves that go to the deep belly of the masseter, and then we have these different neurons innervating different fibrils within that nerve, which is all kind of amazing. But it's all the masseteric nerve. And then by some magic, the brain is able to, on those wires, to say this amount contract. And it's sort of distributed through it. It's not like a specific spot. Like when we do Botox on somebody, we kind of spread that out, right? We don't hit like just one little tiny area. We spread it out. And that's what the body does too.
So both bellies are contracting the same amount?
Not necessarily. So it would depend on what your brain is wanting you to do. So if you wanted to bring your jaw sort of straight up, so to speak, it would be more deep segment. If you're bringing your jaw more in this way, anterior superior, it would be more superficial segment. So that's why, you know, with my jaw right now, I can do all sorts of stuff with speaking and things like that. So chewing is also complicated, but the things we do with our jaw are pretty amazing. And so my brain will use all of these muscles to bring my jaw into specific positions. Cool stuff. All right, lateral pterygoid, which is, again, kind of an amazing muscle, or muscles, you should say. So we have our inferior belly and our superior belly. The inferior belly contracts if we want to move our jaw side to side or straight forward. Okay, that's what it does. The superior head tenses, contracts when we close our jaw. So if we open, lateral pterygoid will contract too, but the superior belly doesn't. When we close, the superior belly contracts to help stabilize the disc. Okay, the disc is attached to this muscle up front. Nothing is making it go backwards. Okay, it goes backwards because it has an intimate relationship with the condylar head, and it wants to go back with it. And I'll show you here cases where it gets out of place. All right, but these muscles work opposite each other. When this one contracts, this one's relaxed. When this one contracts, this one's relaxed. Okay, now what does it do? Again, it shortens, so this is going to bring the condyle this way on opening or bringing our jaw side to side. Temporalis, huge fan-shaped muscle. Now again, because of the orientation of the fibers, if we contract back here, we would basically pull the jaw backwards, right? Or here would be more up and back, here would be straight up. This muscle, if you dissect this, you remember dissection, it's going to be thickest here and thinnest back here. Why? More forces straight up, well, we use it more there too. So our anterior temporalis is much thicker than our posterior temporalis. Okay, let's try this real quick. If you will palpate your anterior temporalis for me, put your fingers on your temple and clench, you should feel that. Okay, put your fingers on your posterior temporalis and clench, and you'll feel little or nothing. Okay, now with your fingers on your posterior temporalis, retrude your mandible. You should feel that contract. Put your fingers on your anterior temporalis, retrude your mandible. You won't feel anything. Make sense? Yeah, it makes sense. Because those muscles are, that's how they work. All right. Now, let's have a little challenge here before I move on to this with our muscle mastication. So I want everybody to clench your teeth right now as hard as you can. Clench your teeth as hard as you can. And move your jaw side to side at the same time without relaxing the clenching straight up and down. Clench your teeth as hard as you can and move your jaw side to side at the same time. I'm not seeing a lot of people's jaws moving side to side. Why is that? Okay, you can stop now. Why is that? Your temporalis, master, and medial pterygoid are stronger. So you've got three big, meaty muscles that are elevators. You got one little wimpy lateral pterygoid sitting there going, it's not doing nothing. You tried. You tried, didn't you? And you contracted your lateral pterygoid. It just couldn't do anything. Okay, it'd be like having a battle between your bicep and your leg muscles. Okay, you just can't do it. Okay, here's a point with that. Have you ever had patients who have tremendous facial pain and no tooth wear? Or it doesn't appear that they have tooth wear. Maybe they have facets when you really look close. Their occlusion looks gorgeous. Why? Because they clenched it into gorgeousness, right? It's the orthodontist dream, a clencher. Put it all, let it settle, right? We let it settle. That helps. What about somebody with a lot of tooth wear, no pain? You ever seen that? You're like, oh my gosh, this person have worn their teeth down like crazy. You must be in a lot of pain. Patient's like, no, I'm fine. No big deal. I'm good. I don't grind my teeth. I'll get to that. You're like, you don't? Okay, so lateral pterygoid can have pain, don't get me wrong. But just the forces that are involved there to allow people to move side to side and do that can be less sometimes than pure clenching. A pure clencher can put incredible forces on not only their teeth, but recruit way more muscle fibers. So they can have a lot of pain. Whereas for those of us that just use it a little, so again, kind of back to my analogy here, you know, doing this, and some of you have a lot of experience with doing this, right? Okay, does that cause muscle pain? Do you get huge biceps from lifting your glass? No, but if I did this, you know, if I just sat here and did this for like 3 hours, I'd probably be a little tired at the end. So your patients that just are swallowing during the night, no big deal. Your patients that are clenching during the night, they can have a lot of pain. Okay, and it's kind of hard for you to differentiate because you look at their teeth and they may look the same. All right, you got your little notepads there. Get out your notepad, get a clean piece of paper, and write down all of the terminal branches of the trigeminal nerve. Here's just a visual stimulation to help you. Okay, that's what this is showing here. This is all trigeminal nerve. We are the experts of the trigeminal nerve. Believe it or not, you all knew this at one point or another. you've lost a little bit of that knowledge over there because it's not that critical for you to know. Okay, but just understanding this basic stuff I'm giving you today is critical. The trigeminal nerve gives more information to the cerebral cortex than any other nerve. There's more space devoted for information from the trigeminal nerve than any other sensory nerve. Why? Why would the brain be so concerned with this area? Survival. Okay, what type of stuff is this area involved with? Eating. Breathing. Drinking, hearing, speaking, seeing, hearing. Okay, all of these, communication, all these things are important to our survival. Of that list of all those things that I just gave there, what is the most important to our survival? Breathing. Right? Okay, we can go days without food. Excuse me, weeks without food, days without water, minutes without air. So the brain is always concerned with your airway. What's going on with your airway from second to second? It wants to know. Okay? We have our different divisions, V1, V2, V3, which we've talked about over and over again. This is for sensory, just to touch, V1, V2, V3. Front, so all the way down to the tip of your nose is V1, V2, maxillary, V3, mandible. Okay, and this is a cool slide here. So V1, V2, V3. And then, what the heck is this? C2-3. What's that supposed to mean? Cervical nerves. Cervical nerves? What does that mean? Where do these nerves come from? Your cervical vertebrae. These are spinal nerves. Okay, all this stuff is cranial nerves, right? V1, V2, V3, or the trigeminal nerve is a cranial nerve. Comes out through the foramina that we talked about, goes straight to the spot. So this area can be innervated by cervical nerves. All right, so let's go through a little differential diagnosis here real quick. Okay, so if someone comes in and they say they have pain right here, I have a beard, this is my jaw. Okay, what are some of the things that may be going on? And don't say this one first, okay? Think as a dentist first. Think as a dentist first. Tooth. Wouldn't you think that first? If someone comes in and says, I have pain in my jaw, are you immediately going to be like, well, maybe your back is out? No, you're going to be like, hey, maybe it's a tooth. Let's look. Okay, so it could be a wisdom tooth. Could be a second molar, right? Okay, could be a tooth. Next, could be masseter muscle. I'm right on the masseter muscle. Could be what else? Could be jaw problem, maybe referred pain from the jaw joint. Could be what else? Parotid gland, very good, thank you. I'm right on the parotid gland. Or lastly, could be a neck problem. Okay, same spot. Okay, tooth, masseter muscle, parotid gland, TMJ referred pain, or neck. Okay, now here's the crazy one here. So this is right here. Check it out. It's like up here by your earlobe. This is cervical innervation. Touching right here, that is not going to your brain through the same nerve that tapping your tooth does. It's your neck. It's going to your neck. So someone could have a vertebrae a little out of place or something like that, collapsed vertebrae, and they could have pain in their jaw that has to do with their neck. Now, all of you have experienced this innervation in your career if you've practiced long enough. How many of you have been working on a second molar and the patient, your block was perfect, you could cut the person's lip off, all the other teeth are totally dead, and there's a spot on this freaking second molar that every time you touch it, boom, it's like you did nothing. Anyone had that?
Yeah.
Yeah, you've had that. Okay, that is cervical innervation of that tooth. Look it up. I don't make this crap up. It's really hard to just like blow smoke on anatomy. Anatomy's been a dead science for about 100 years. So you can Google this, cervical innervation of second molars. Okay? And find the articles on it, them finding these nerves going to these teeth. So if you ever have that happen, what you've done in the past is you do like a PDL injection. That works. Duh, because it's going to get get around the tooth. You can also just go on the lingual. Or, if you're crazy like me, you would do it extraorally and just go right there. Because like that's the most direct, obvious approach, and I can clean the skin and stuff like that. So that's what I would do. You wouldn't do that, though. You'd go inside the deep, dark hole, right? Because you all like going inside the deep, dark hole. I don't like going inside the deep dark hole if I can help it. I'm like a medical doctor. Medical doctors will not go inside the deep dark hole with a needle. They'll go outside the deep dark hole, no problem. Okay, we're the opposite. Dentists, once we go outside the deep dark hole, it's like, oh my gosh, you know, don't make me do that. Okay, all cool on that? So hopefully that's something you learned today, that cervical innervation can be involved here. Temporomandibular joint. This is a arthrogigmoidal joint. Rotation occurs in the upper joint compartment. Translation occurs in the lower compartment, so to speak. Innervated by the auriculotemporal nerve, which is also V3, so the same nerve that goes to the muscles of mastication. Posterior deep temporal nerve and masseteric nerve, all V3. It's all V3. Okay, so the disc kind of sits on top of the condyle, and back here are just some fibers that help keep it from going too far, but they're not like rubber bands. They don't pull things back. Okay? So the disc stays on the condyle because of its shape, because it wants to stay there. So there's some nice Netter drawings of the disc and the capsule and how that all works. The disc attaches on the sides to the condyle, but not in the front and the back. And that allows it to move freely, but unfortunately, it also allows the disc to displace. So the disc can get completely out of place in some people. All right, so let me start here. On the disc itself, the disc is avascular. No nerves, no blood vessels. This tissue back here is called the retrodiscal tissue. It is chock full of nerves and blood vessels. All right, so if this disc were to displace, what would the condyle be pushing on? The retrodiscal tissue, nerves and blood vessels. Okay, so if it's all the way it's supposed to be, if you were designing this system, where would you put the forces? Against this little cushion that has no blood vessels or nerves, against this dang thick piece of bone here called the articular eminence or the tubercle. Not up here. This is one cell layer thick. It's really thin up here. You wouldn't push straight up. That would be dumb. You would put it across this way, which happens to be how the muscles pull. The muscles want to be in that position. Okay? Except some of them pull straight up, and that can cause a problem, which we'll see here in a second. Okay, there's our lateral pterygoid again. Meckel's cartilage, kind of bringing some stuff home here. And this is kind of cool. So this is something called Pinto's ligament or the malleomandibular ligament. This has to do with the embryology that we started off with of how all this stuff came together. All of the tissues you see on the screen right there all formed from the same embryological tissue. The ear ossicles, things like that. These muscles, the mandible. And we have this so-called malleomandibular ligament which can continue in an adult. All right? Clinically, what could be something that we would notice with this? That people with a jaw problem might also present with what kind of issues? Ear problems. Like, for example, ringing in the ears. Or feeling of congestion in the ear. Very, very common. Lots of times, people with jaw problems will report that it feels muffled. Oftentimes, they've had a hearing test and it was normal. Okay, but they'll say it feels muffled. Yes, sir?
Can you point to the ligament again?
Right here. So this is the malleus mandibular ligament. This is showing the superior head of the lateral pterygoid actually coming back and attaching to the ossicles.
What's the other thing?
What thing where?
Going down.
Like here?
Yeah. No, really. No.
This thing here? So this is just showing Meckel's cartilage and kind of where it all is.
Yeah.
So malleus, incus. This is like the temporalis muscle coming down. Oh, this thing here?
Yeah.
I don't know what that's indicating there. Yeah, I think that's just kind of the rest of this bone here coming up. Because that would be part of the... Yeah, just part of the sphenoid bone going up there. Okay? So anyway, let's try something really quick. There's not a heck of a lot of background noise in this room. Let's check for a second. Not much. Okay, so I want you to clench your teeth together in a second. So you'll kind of pay attention to the background noise that's in the room, any of it. Clench your teeth, relax, clench your teeth, relax, see if it makes any difference with the background noise. How many of you does clenching your teeth make a difference with the background noise? Raise your hand. Raise it really high. Okay, look around, everybody. Raise your hands. Look around. Okay, everyone with their hands raised is normal. Do you know why they're normal? Because when I clench my teeth together, it makes a difference with the background noise. And I am the definition of normal. Okay, now for you, that may not work for you, so that would not be normal for you, but it is for me. Okay? Now, the reason I bring this up and make that little joke is this is sort of not a joke. We're all going to perceive everything based on our perception. We're all going to judge everything based on our experience. So if you had a patient come in and say, hey, doc, when I clench my teeth together, it makes it quieter. You're going to be like, ooh, crazy. You know what? I haven't even covered that yet. How could I be over an hour in my lecture so far and not make one of the biggest points possible, which is all TMJ patients are crazy. I mean, normally that's how I start my lecture. Right? All TMJ patients are nuts. Right? Why? No, you're sad. Everybody thinks they're nuts. Everyone thinks they're crazy. Why? Because it doesn't make sense to you. Okay? Because it's not the tooth. Because it's something else. Because they have ringing in their ears after you did a filling. There's no way in hell that's related. Or is it? They have headaches after you did something. Oh, that can't be related. Or could it? Okay, when you don't understand something, the easiest scapegoat is the patient to be crazy. Don't get me wrong. There are some TMJ patients that are crazy. There are some of your denture patients that are crazy. There are some of your implant patients that are crazy. There are a hell of a lot of your cosmetic patients that are crazy.
We're all crazy.
A lot of patients are crazy.
We are all crazy.
Okay, so you get this here? So for those of us who raised our hand, I believe that when we clench our teeth, we tense up something here that dampens how these ossicles move, and it makes it quieter. If you have ringing in your ear, so here's a little pearl for you. If you have a patient with ringing ears, you have ringing ears yourself, I believe I can help someone with ringing in their ears if they can modulate the ringing by doing something with their jaw. If they clench their teeth and it modulates the ringing. If they move their jaw and it modulates the ringing. If they do anything and it modulates it. I didn't say make it better. If it makes it louder, less, higher pitched, anything, anything. If they can do something with their jaw that changes the sound, probably I can help them. If they can do anything with their jaw and it makes no difference at all, I probably can't help them. I'll take a question. No, I won't. Oh, yes, I will. What? Is that you can do that. So it's possible that some splint therapy might help your ringing. Okay? But if they can't change anything, in my experience, highly unlikely.
What percentage of the time?
I have no clue. So the question is, what percentage of the time will that happen?
That you can solve ringing in the ears.
Oh, geez.
150%.
I would give it 50% of the people that can modulate the sound. Yeah, I wouldn't be quite that optimistic on... Because if you had an ENT doctor that sent you all of their ringing in the ear patients, that's all you would do for a living, is treat ringing in the ears. Because they see them all day long, and they have no clue what's going on. A lot of them are jaw problems. Okay, we can help them. Okay, yep.
Just recently, an ENT sent me a patient, and I found a trigger point in his masseter.
Yeah, trigger point in the masseter.
And as I was doing the compression,
yes,
his tinnitus diminished.
Yeah, very good. So he was talking about a muscle issue related to the tinnitus. Okay, one more question, then move on. Yep. Go ahead.
My wife has a lot of ringing in her ear.
Yes. And did the mouth guard have any effect at all? Better, worse, anything?
Well, she does say that it's a little bit better when she wears.
Okay, so then probably she needs to do it more. Okay, I'll talk about something in a minute called the aqualizer that could be helpful also. But what the issue may be with your wife is that maybe it's not a nighttime problem. So you've got her in a night guard, and that's kind of like me wearing a knee brace all the time except when I play basketball. You know what I'm saying? As dentists, we do that a lot. Well, here's a night guard. Hopefully your problem's at night. You know what I'm saying? I don't know why we assume that all these problems are nighttime, but we do. Okay. All right, craniofacial pain exam. So let's get into our exam here. For crying out loud, I was hibernating. Don't you guys ever take a pulse? Okay, so some basic, you know, science here. You want to take a pulse, so to speak. All right. This is one of my favorite far sides. Proper diagnosis is the key to proper treatment. If your diagnosis is wrong, how likely is your treatment to be right? Unlikely. Now, sometimes we get lucky, don't we? Now, our medical colleagues, people in medicine, treat based on what they think is going on, oftentimes without any objective data. Case in point, ear infection. Okay? Sinusitis. You go to a doc in the box and you say, I got pressure right here and a headache, you're getting an antibiotic, aren't you? They cannot see that you've got a sinusitis. They didn't stick something up your nose to swab it or whatever. They just assume, and they put you on an antibiotic, and if you're better in 7 to 10 days, then you apparently had a sinus infection. Or you just got better in 7 to 10 days, which is usually the case. All right? If you don't get better based on the drugs they put you on, then eventually they get a CAT scan, and they look and say, oh, you didn't have a sinus problem in the first place. There's something else going on. Okay? So that's called treating empirically. As dentists, we don't tend to do that. So proper diagnosis, key to proper treatment. If our diagnosis is wrong, our treatment is usually wrong. Sometimes we get lucky, but it's usually wrong. Here's the far side I like to prove this point with. The hound dog says, I can't smell a damn thing. So how likely is this posse to find the bad guy? Not very likely, right? All right, so here's some of the stuff you want to use in your evaluation or diagnosis of a TMJ problem. A pano, you get a health history, history of the jaw problem, opening, palpation of the jaw joint, sprain, stretch procedure, initial diagnosis, go over those individually. Why a pano? Well, a pano because you all have a pano. So it's an easy film to get. It gives you all the information. I always look at a pano on my patients because I want to rule out dental pathology, first of all. So my practice, if I haven't mentioned this yet, I don't think I have, this is all I do. I treat sleep problems and TMD. Okay? Now here's the really weird part. It's all I've ever done. When I left dental school, I went directly into a TMD limited practice. Now I don't start my lecture with that because half of you would leave because you'd say, this guy's obviously crazy. Who in the right mind would go straight into a TMJ practice out of dental school? But I did. I'm from the Boise, Idaho area. There happened to be a guy there who had started this practice 15 years earlier, had limited his practice. So my practice has over 30 plus years of history of just treating this stuff. And that's all I do. Okay. So anyway, I get referrals, a lot of referrals from medical doctors. And they'll miss dental stuff all the time. So we take a pan and go, oh, well, you have an abscess tooth, or you have a big cavity, or you have something like that, and get them off to my dental colleagues to take care of that. Okay. When the pano comes from the dentist, usually the teeth are fine, so then I'm looking at other stuff. I get a vague idea of TMJ morphology. Not great. Pano's not a great film for the jaw joint, but better than nothing. I evaluate a couple things. Condylar coronoid process. If the coronoid process is really long, that's oftentimes an indication of so-called parafunction. They're clenching. It's pulling on that coronoid process. If you have a really long coronoid process, really, really, really long, okay, what could that be?
Artifact.
No? Usually not an artifact, necessarily. Unless they did it wrong.
Malposition.
Yeah, it could be they're positioned wrong. But if the rest of the panel looks perfect and you've got a big, long coronoid process, it could be coronoid impingement. Okay, you will see this typically in teenage guys, 17, 18, 19 years old. And the history will be, I've been pretty much normal and now all of a sudden I can't open very wide. Okay, and the coronoid grows to the point where it can't clear the maxilla. All right? And they'll open and it just stops. And you get a cone beam CT or a normal CT and you'll see it. When they open, it'll be bang right against there and the surgeon just goes and cuts it. Yes?
How do you know if the coronoid is too long or the condyle is too short?
You would take a cone beam CT on that patient and have them open wide and see if it's the coronoid stopping at the maxilla is why they can't open. Okay, so you have some sort of exam form. This is one of my older ones, but it says, you know, what are your chief complaints, and put them down. It's always a red flag if they mark every single one of these, right? A lot of people do. It's like, oh, 27 chief complaints. You know, I'm looking for the top three or four. I want them to put them in order for me, okay? Some of the stuff we look for on their health history, current use of selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor antidepressants. Now, sunny, beautiful California, probably you don't have any patients that are on antidepressants, do you? Ha 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 ha. You don't have any patients that aren't on antidepressants, do you? It's kind of the thing, kind of the national drug here. So why would I put that as one of my first things here to look at? Does anyone know? Selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors can cause
bruxism.
Bruxism. Okay? If you didn't know that, write that down. Okay? Because you will have patients that come in and their history is, I've never had a jaw problem my whole life. I'm 50 years old. I started Prozac 6 months ago, which they won't tell you, so you have to ask. And my jaw's been bothering me for 5 months. I get that about once a quarter. It scares me to death how often it happens. Because what happens is when you miss this and you send them to someone else, you send them to a surgeon, they probably get surgery. You send them to an orthodontist, they probably get ortho. Their problems are drug. Okay? And I've got the reference for this on the next slide, I think, so that you can write down. Trauma. And oftentimes this trauma is a long time ago. You do in kind of your clinical exam, you might see a scar on the chin. You ask, like, do you have any trauma, any history of trauma? Oh, no. What's this mark on your chin here? Oh, yeah. When I was 4 years old, I fell off my bicycle. Do you think falling off your bicycle hard enough to cause a scar on your chin could screw up your condylar development there a little bit? Maybe cause a jaw problem down the road? Yeah, I do too. Okay, so sometimes a trauma a long time ago. Rheumatoid arthritis. One of the ways of diagnosing rheumatoid arthritis by rheumatologists is palpation of the jaw joint and it hurts. Now, ironically, if we're treating this, it's not covered by medical insurance, which is weird, right? But rheumatoid arthritis affects all the other joints. It can affect this one too. Previous treatment. This is your bag of dentures patient, right? Except this is the bag of splints patient. If you have a bag of splints patient, if you have someone that comes into you and they're like, well, I've seen this person and 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 this person, and I've got all these different splints and all this stuff, please do not have the hubris to be like, oh, well, let me see what you got. Obviously, that splint didn't work because it doesn't have anterior guidance. This person, obviously, this splint didn't work because it hits in the back. It should only hit in the front. Obviously, this splint didn't work because you only wore it at night. You should have worn it 24 hours a day with eating. Obviously, this didn't work because you wore it to eat. Obviously, this didn't work because it was on the upper. It should have been on the bottom. Obviously, this didn't work because it was on the lower. It should have been on the upper. Right? It's all about the magic plastic and how it's adjusted and how it's whatever. Bull, loney. Okay, I had a patient just exactly like this in Colorado. She'd seen everybody. Everybody. You know how long she gave the average practitioner before they could cure her problem that she'd had for about 30 years? About 3 weeks. She'd wear their splint for, you know, half-heartedly for about 3 weeks, probably more not than did. And then she wasn't, you know, miraculously cured by 3 weeks, so she'd move on to the next doctor. And I told her, I'm sure I can't help you either. I'm happy to take your money like the rest of the people have and have you not do what I tell you to. I mean, seriously, I was that straightforward with her. I'm like, you can pay me all the money and you can not do exactly what I say and I'll give you the stuff and then you'll have just another one and then you can tell people you're treated by Jameson Spencer too. You can add that one to your list. That'll be awesome for you. Or you can take this seriously and do exactly what I tell you and you give me, how long have you had your problem? 30 years. I need 30 years to get you better. It's only fair. And she laughs and I go, seriously, I need at least 6 months to a year. As chronic as you are. As screwed up as you are. Do we got a deal? And she said, we got a deal. And she's doing quite a bit better now. Okay? Not necessarily because I'm so much more awesome than the other people. It's just she never actually did what they told her to. So watch for this. Previous treatment. Migraine headaches, I'll talk about more in just a second. Okay, so here's our stuff on SSRI-induced bruxism. Write this down. Journal of Clinical Psychiatry, December 1999. Buspirone is an antidote to SSRI-induced bruxism in 4 cases. It's a really nice article. And what I'll do when I suspect this is I will usually call the neurologist or the family doctor or whoever put him on the drugs and say, hey, I've got this patient. I suspect this is what's going on. Do you mind if I put him on buspirone and send him back to you? And they say, yeah, that's cool. I send him the article. First of all, I say, doctor, have you ever heard of this? Antidepressants causing bruxism? They always say no. Psychiatrists, who this is all they do all day long is give out these drugs, they don't know about it. Okay? So I will fax them the article, put them on the drug, send them back to whoever put them on the drug in the first place. And I've had many, many patients where this takes care of it. It's their medication. It's not anything else.
So what does that do?
What's
Buspirone? Buspirone is a different antidepressant, but the cool thing about this model here is you don't have to take them off of their SSRI. So if they're on Zoloft, for example, and it's working, you know, emotionally or whatever, it's working for them, you can put them on Buspirone and they don't have to change it. Now, if it's not working in the first place, if they're like, oh, I'm on Prozac, I hate it, well, then just they can put them on something else, like Wellbutrin, for example. SSRIs are Prozac, Zoloft, Celexa, Paxil. Okay? And again, sometimes you need to ask this because patients don't automatically put those drugs down on your health history because you're a dentist and you don't need to know that they're on antidepressants. So you might have to ask. You say, hey, I see you're having jaw problems. Again, you're 50 years old. You've never had a problem. You've been my patient for 15 years. Has anything changed? Are there any new medications that you're on that you haven't had a chance to write down yet? Oh, yeah, I forgot to put down on my Prozac. Okay.
Why does it cause bruxism?
What causes bruxism anyway? Malocclusion. No, I'm just pulling your chain, dude. So you got to come to my sleep lecture.
So why would this medication cause bruxism and not occlusion?
Well, that's why you read this article. So the article is going to go into all sorts of neurochemistry on why it causes it. And I think it's true, but I think there's other reasons it causes it too. But I don't have time to talk about it right now. Okay? All right, so let's go through this again. Previously, migraine headaches. Now let's talk about that. Who in here has... Okay, quick. It's Buspirone, 10 milligrams twice a day. Read the article, though. Okay, it walks you right through it. If you can't find the article, go to my website, jamisonspencer.com, downloads. It's on there. jamisonspencer.com, downloads. It's on there. All right, let's talk about migraines. Who in here has migraine headaches? Well, front row. Migraine. You mind if I pick on you?
Oh, God.
You're on the front row.
All right.
You're fair game. So who diagnosed you with your migraine headaches?
It was my pediatrician at
Juneau. Oh, my gosh. You've had migraines since you were a little kid. Oh, wow. Do you take any migraine medications like Zomig, nothing like that?
No. So I take a combination of aspirin and Tylenol.
Aspirin and Tylenol you take? If you feel it coming on. Do you have any kind of prodrome or anything like that? You do? Okay, but you don't take the abortive medications. Have you ever tried them? You haven't tried them. Okay. Next. Yep. Migraine headaches as a teenager. Okay. Same type of questions. Do you take Zomig or...
I can't pronounce it correctly. It's Budil Acetate.
Okay. And you do take that when you feel it coming on.
Yes.
Does it abort the migraine?
15 minutes.
And it's gone. Okay. You have migraines. Okay. Next. Yep. Okay. Does this sound familiar?
Since I was a kid, yeah.
Since you're a kid, too. All right. Does anyone have migraine headaches? It's not since they're a kid. Okay. I'm just going to move on. I'm going to give you the classic classic here. So this was very bizarre. So these three people, I believe, have migraines, which is quite rare in my experience. So most people with migraines are actually tension headaches. And they are usually self-diagnosed. That's why I always ask who diagnosed you. And these people actually had people that diagnosed them. Usually they'll say, I did. Okay. Usually if you ask about the different medications that people will take for migraines that abort the migraine, they've tried it and it takes the edge off. Okay? Takes the edge off. Okay, and this is one of the big reasons that we have an increase in migraine diagnosis, so to speak, especially self-diagnosis. Doctor, if you had an assistant come in and she said, Doctor, I got a bit of a headache. What are you going to say? Take some Advil and get back to work is the implied end of that sentence. Right? Okay. Now you got an assistant that comes to you. Doctor, I think I got a migraine coming on. Now what are you going to say?
Take some Advil and get to work.
No, come on. You are not. What are you going to say?
Well, is it real migraine?
Is it go home is probably what you're going to say, right? All of us compassionate people in the room are saying, go home, take the day off. It's a migraine. Are people with migraines treated differently than people with headaches?
Yes.
Absolutely. So there's a different way we react to them. All right? Oh, I don't have... Sorry. What if I do this?
Plus sensitivity to light, sound, even nausea. And it's number one neurologist recommended. Migraines are where Excedrin excels.
Did you get that commercial? So that's for Excedrin migraine. Sue, who said that? That stuff's awesome. Love it, right? Awesome, Excedrin migraine. So Excedrin migraine is why a lot of people have diagnosed themselves with migraines. Okay? And what is in Excedrin migraine? You can see on the box here, acetaminophen, aspirin, and caffeine. Cool. That's good. But have you ever heard of Excedrin? Now, you've never heard of Excedrin because there's no such thing as Excedrin. There's only Excedrin extra strength because who the hell would buy normal strength Excedrin? What is the point of that? So there's Excedrin extra strength. Well, let's see what's in it. Huh, acetaminophen, aspirin, and caffeine. What? The boxes are different. So here they are, and I love this marketing piece that I found, and I love how they put them as far away as possible on the screen here, because otherwise you would notice that these are the same drug in different boxes. Okay? They're the same drug. These ones have different stuff in them, but these are the same, identical. And Excedrin was the first one to do it, because I'm sure that they were out doing their job and stuff, and somebody said, oh my gosh, I love Excedrin. Because it makes my migraines go away. And they're like, what? Ooh, let's go to the FDA and see if we can get approval to market this stuff to stupid people to want migraine medication. And the FDA said, well, you haven't killed anybody yet with this combination, so sure, go for it. And they couldn't keep this crap off on the shelves. People are buying, because again, you are the normal patient. You go into the drugstore and you're like, man, I got a headache today. Let's see what I can take here. Okay, anything that doesn't say extra strength, forget about that. Let's look for some extra strength at least. Wait, migraine? That's what I've got. I've got a migraine. Okay, I'm talking to some of you in the room here. I know I am. Because you've got it in your purse right now. I guarantee you, you've got Excedrin migraine in your purse. So you're taking your Excedrin migraine because you got migraines. Right? So they diagnose themselves with migraine, and from now on, because it works. So obviously, I have migraines. Okay? Interesting. So then, Advil sees their sales going down the freaking tank there because they don't have this. So they invent Advil migraine, which is 200 milligrams ibuprofen. Okay? So if you ever have a patient and ibuprofen is just not cutting it, put them on Advil migraine. Dead serious. Be like, be careful with this stuff. Only take one, maybe two. It's really strong. It's Advil migraine. Careful. And they'll take it and be like, oh my gosh, doc, thanks so much for the Advil migraine. That stuff just whoo, took care of it. Okay? Totally dead serious about this. As a matter of fact, it's so funny. You can Google this. Excedrin, if you Google like Excedrin migraine, you'll find a YouTube video of when they had a problem with the tablets and they had to take it off the market for a little bit. And there was like riots in the street going on with this and all this stuff going to the manufacturer of Excedrin going, dude, I got to have my Excedrin migraine. I'm going to die. And guess what they did not do? They did not say, wait a second, everybody, you're going to think this is funny, but it's the same as Excedrin. It's the same stuff. Just... it's a different box. No worries. Just go get yourself some extra strength. It's the same stuff. They didn't say that. They said, we know that this is a huge problem for people. We are working 24 hours a day, 7 days a week to get this back on the market as quick as we can. Smart. Okay, they had people in lines. It's like the iPhone, 8 came out or something, and they're waiting to get their migraine medication. You just take it for fun, yeah? No, it's good. It's great. Me too. So, and that's because the caffeine gets it out of your stomach really fast, and so it works fast. Yeah, I agree. I take it too, because I have migraines. I'm just kidding. All right, initial exam. So, getting to our initial exam, we have our history of our jaw problem. What is the chief complaint? Okay, if you have a person that comes into your office with a jaw problem and you don't understand what the chief complaint is, you might treat something else. So, if their chief complaint is clicking, and you've been taught that clicking is no big deal. Who cares? People click. So what? But that's their chief complaint. That's why they're there. So you treat them, and they had headaches, let's say. And their headaches get better. And you're like, look, hey, patient, your headaches are better. Good for you. And they're like, so what? You didn't help me. What are you talking about? I didn't help you. You used to have headaches every day. I came in because my jaw clicks. Oh, clicking's not important. Who cares about clicking? The patient goes, I care about clicking. That's why I came here in the first place. Okay, so understand what their chief complaint is, because you may not be able to help. It may be my chief complaint is ringing in the ears that I've had. And oh, by the way, I was a DJ, and on the weekends, I shot shotguns all weekend long. My ears ring. I don't understand why. Okay, you get my point? You may not be able to help their chief complaint, so you can't take on the case in the first place. Where does it hurt? This is the one finger test. Ask the patient to point with one finger to where it hurts the most. One finger. Because then your anatomy lesson that we had will take effect. Because otherwise, if you say, patient, well, where does it hurt? They go like this, don't they? You're like, well, it kind of hurts here. You're like, that's too much anatomy for me to wrap my brain around. So where does it hurt the most? And then if they're a woman, they'll go like, I'll say, point with one finger to where it hurts. If they're a woman, they'll go like, well, it's like here. Like, no, point with the tip of your finger to where it hurts. Here. Okay, I'll maybe temporalis, occipital, jaw joint, whatever. Okay, so then I can start wrapping my brain around it. One finger test. You ever heard that joke, this old Yiddish joke? Like, the doctor says, where's it hurt? And it's like, point, it's like, ow. Ow, ow, ow. Diagnosis? Broken finger, very good. Broken finger. When did symptoms start? Do you think it's different treating a patient who says, you know what, my jaw started bothering me last week when I got hit playing basketball, versus my jaw started bothering me when I was 14 years old and got my braces off, and now I'm 55? Yeah. Okay, so you need to know when it started. Maximum opening, normal is 48 to 52 without pain. Rule of fingers, this is the Boy Scout sign. If they do Boy Scout sign and go like this, that's normal. Not like this. All right, that's too small. Like that. Palpation of the jaw joint, there's different disc displacements, crepitus, we'll go over that in a second. Patient perceives noise on the same side you detect it. So if you feel the jaw joint and you think it's on the right, but the patient says, no, it clicks on the left, then you want to look at that a little bit more. Unable to detect noise the patient hears. Okay, we have another test for each other. Okay, so this will be easier for me because I have water, but I want you to put your teeth together, put your teeth in occlusion, and swallow, and see if you hear anything in your ears. Say, put your teeth together, swallow. Okay, how many of you get a noise in your ears? Raise your hands really high, everyone look around. Okay, everybody with their hands in the air are normal. Why are they normal? Happens to me. Okay, so when I swallow, I get that noise in my ears. What is that noise in my ears? Anatomus, my eustachian tubes opening and closing. All of you people that didn't raise your hand, I don't know what's wrong with you. Because if your eustachian tube opens and closes, you would think you'd be able to hear it because it's attached to your middle ear. Okay, so all the rest of us are normal. So I've had patients come in, and that's their chief complaint. My jaw clicks. Really? And you're palpating, you're feeling, you get nothing. And then it's like, oh, it's when I swallow. And they swallow, and you got nothing. So if for those of us who swallowed and got the noise, was that our disc out of place? No, everything was stabilized with our teeth together. Can't be the disc. Okay, for those of you who swallow and get it, how many of you get it when you just open too? Same noise. I do. How many of you? I'm the only one. Okay, there you go. Again, a station tube. Open and closing. Spray and stretch procedure is using ethyl chloride to go over the place it hurts. I'll use this stuff, spray it over the face. So if she had jaw pain, I'd spray it right in here. This is great to use. After I spray it on their face, I will ask them, does that make the discomfort worse, better, or no change? Okay. So I'm a big believer in diagnosis. You want to minimize placebo. Because if I do something, so if I take the ethyl chloride and I go spray, and I go, that makes that feel better, doesn't it? Then the patient's going to say, yeah. Because I got all these letters after my name and stuff, and I'm in this building, I got a tie on. Okay? But if I spray, and I sit there for a second, I go, does that make it worse, better, or no change? Then they have to think. Because I just sprayed a cold spray on their face that should make it better. All right? I'm trying to figure out site and source of their pain. Site and source of their pain. Okay. Let me throw in another pearl. This is from my sleep lecture, so you'll hear me talk about this later. But someone talked about bruxism a second ago. And this is not part of this lecture, but I'll give you a pearl. if I ask you, Linda, do you clench or grind your teeth?
Yeah.
Okay. Yes? Do you clench or grind your teeth? Do you clench or grind your teeth?
Yes.
Okay, is there anyone in this room that doesn't clench or grind their teeth? Come on, give me a break. Someone, raise your hand. All of you clench and grind your teeth. Okay, we are screwed up. And you're all on Prozac too, aren't you? Just go home. Okay, play with me here, Linda. Pretend you don't clench or grind your teeth.
Okay.
That you don't think you do. Okay. So you're going to say no. Linda, do you clench or grind your teeth?
No.
You don't? No. Yes, you do. Okay, so here's my point with that whole theatrics there. If you ask your patient if they clench or grind their teeth and they say no, where are you going with that? You now have an argument. You know, yes, you do, because I can see it. Mm-hmm. And the patient's like, I'm with myself all the time, and I'm not aware. So here's what you ask. Linda, are you aware of clenching or grinding your teeth? Okay, and they may say, no, I'm not. You say, you know what? I think you might. And here's what I see that makes me think that. Or I think maybe you did at some point in your life. I'm seeing wear on your teeth. That could have been from 10 years ago, I guess, but I don't know. Do you have anything else going on? Okay, just a little pearl. Just that's free. That's free there. Okay, are you aware of clenching or grinding your teeth? Are you aware? Do not ask, do you? If you ask, do you, and they say no, then you're done. Okay, you can only ask, are you aware? All right, initial diagnosis, we may say, well, there's no treatment indicated. They came in, you know, they called, they got a jaw problem, they get in a week later and they don't have it anymore. So they're good. You may put them on anti-inflammatories, home physical therapy, aqualizer. I'll talk about the aqualizer in a second. I like using ibuprofen. If it's a really bad case, I'll use ibuprofen migraine. So 600 milligrams every 6 hours for 6 days. Ice and moist heat, 10 minutes and moist heat, and the aqualizer. All right. This is the aqualizer. How many of you are familiar with the aqualizer? You should all have this. I have nothing to do with this company, but you can say, hey, Jameson said this is a good thing to get. They're good people. So I say it's two lakes connected by a river. Okay. The nice thing about this is it self-adjusts. It lets their jaw go where their jaw wants to go. Okay. Because otherwise our jaw goes where? Where's our jaw go? Where our teeth fit. Why do our teeth fit where they fit? This is one of my favorite phrases. Why do our, so I got a room full of dentists and dental professionals here. Why do our teeth fit where they fit?
Balance.
Yes?
Because they're always erupting.
Because they're always erupting. Hmm. Okay. What if I had a 10 millimeter overjet? Wouldn't that mean eventually my front teeth would go down out my bottom lip? or just come out? No, what if they weren't in contact with anything? Balance of forces of what?
Of everything, all the teeth, muscles.
All sorts of stuff. That's why they fit where they fit. Okay. Anyone else?
They like to socialize.
They like to socialize, so it's where they contact. Ooh, I like that one. That's a good one.
Dental work.
Yeah, maybe the dentist. Okay, now let me give you a harder one. Why do my teeth fit where they fit?
Because you're normal.
Because I'm normal. No. Not in this case. Any orthodontists in the audience? Of course not, because why the hell would an orthodontist be in this group? No relation between orthodontics and TMJ. Why would they even be here? Makes no sense. Because I had four bicuspids pulled and thrown in the trash, and everything pulled back, right? So God didn't put my teeth where my teeth fit. An orthodontist did, who thought he was God, but that's, you know. Right? My teeth fit where they fit because that's where they fit. Let me restate that. You might want to write that down. It's quite profound. Teeth fit where they fit because that's where they fit. That's where my teeth fit. And that's where they fit. Okay? Because they like to socialize. They like to interact with each other. If you don't believe me, how many of you wear an oral appliance for sleep? Apnea. Is your bite different in the morning? Of course it's different in the morning. So if we change that position for a few hours, 6-7 hours in the morning, it's like, where the hell do my teeth go? And then your brain's like, what? And then finally, it hopefully finds it because that's where they fit. Okay, I like just throwing that out just to screw with your mind. You'll be thinking about that for like the rest of your life. So anyway, this thing allows the jaws to go wherever they want to go. It allows the muscles and joints to go wherever they want to go. Because normally the teeth are dictating where it all goes. Because they fit where they fit. And the muscles and joints have to play along. The aqualizer will let it go wherever it wants. So for you with the ringing ear wife, try an aqualizer because it will let her jaw go wherever it wants to go. And she'd wear it all the time. Okay? And eat like smoothies for a week or two. You take all the pressure off, let her joggle wherever it wants, and if that changes her ringing, worse or better, that's a good sign. If it changes. Yes, sir? It would not prevent bruxism or clenching, no. And this is a good way to test if they are, because if they break it, then that indicates that they're really putting some forces on it. Okay? So this is a great tool that you should all have for any weird TMJ problems, or also I'll talk about capsulitis here next. Okay, imaging records, various things here. I won't spend any time on this. Cone beam CTs are easy to get now. I'll talk about MRIs in a second. That's my cone beam. There's nice stuff that we can do with a cone beam. Oh, I will make one mention of cone beam real quick. What's this? Airway. Car. So when I started practicing in TMJ, because that's what I did right out of school, right? I had transcranial x-rays. Any of you familiar with those? Okay. Transcranial x-ray, transcranial went across the head and gave you a really crappy image of the jaw joint. And so I usually would base my treatment on what I saw in the jaw joint, in this crappy image, right? What else would I base my treatment on? So my diagnosis, and this was part of my diagnosis. Now, after a few years, I got more sophisticated and I bought a tomogram machine, which gave me a much, much better image of this. So what did I base my treatment on? This, because that's what I looked at. Then, fast forward a few years, and I spend $200,000 and I get a cone beam CT machine. So then I get this, beautiful images of the jaw joints, and I'm like, what? What's this black thing? Never seen that before. What is that? That's their airway. And so I started correlating these little airways and some of these TMJ problems. I started correlating the sleep apnea patient and the TMJ patient. Started correlating that a lot of these TMJ patients had sleep apnea. And it totally changed my paradigm. And now I believe that a huge percentage of TMJ problems are driven by not breathing. Because what does your brain care more about? Air or enamel preservation? Air or jaw pain? Air or headaches? Air or disc being out of place? Air, usually number one. Any list you can come up with, air is going to be number one. Okay, and that came because of this? Totally changed my life. All right, MRI is good for jaw joint stuff too. These are various craniofacial pain disorders. Normally when you come to a course like this, they talk about 50 billion things that you're never going to see in your whole life. I'm going to talk about very specific ones. So the everyday stuff that you're going to see all the time in your practice, this is happening all the time, and most of the time you're missing it. And that is capsulitis, trismus, and disc displacement. Okay, how am I doing for time here? Okay. Capsulitis. Diagnosis, history of trauma, usually. Continuous pain in the jaw joint. Hurts to palpate the jaw joint. Range of motion is not necessarily reduced. There's acute malocclusion on the injured side. What type of malocclusion? If I have a capsulitis, an inflammation of the capsule on the right side, what's going to be going on with my teeth on the right side? Open bite. Very good. Y'all understand that. So if it's swollen up here, that condyle has no place to go but down, so then my teeth can't come together on that side. Okay? Sometimes it's super obvious. You look in and you see that their teeth don't touch. Sometimes the patient just says, I can't get my teeth together. You look and it's pretty close. Maybe even articulating paper, they may make a mark. But if you put shim stock in there, it would pull through. Okay? That's a capsulitis. Pain with clenching, because you're biting down. What are you doing to that swelling? You're pushing that condyle up into it and it hurts. So it hurts for them to get their teeth together. And then here's the secret. No pain with clenching on a tongue depressor. Now, why a tongue depressor versus a cotton roll? Okay, this is part of the no placebo effect in diagnosis. So if someone, if I say, egal, is that pretty good? Is that close? Egal. When you bite your teeth together, is that uncomfortable? Yes. So here's this cotton roll. Let's have you bite on it. What are you intuitively going to think biting on the cotton roll is going to feel like? Better or worse?
Better.
Better. It's a fluffy cotton roll. It's like a little cloud. I'm going to put that in between my teeth. Obviously, it's going to feel better. So you didn't learn anything. So those of you who do that, you didn't learn anything. Okay? A stick, on the other hand, if it hurts to put your teeth together, intuitively, what are you going to think it's going to feel like to bite on a stick? That's going to hurt. So you put the stick in between their teeth, they bite down, and then does it hurt? No, because you just put a space here. Make sense? They can't compress the joint, so it doesn't hurt. Okay, I have diagnosed capsulitis from thousands of miles away by going through this process here over the phone, having the patient take a pen, bite on the pen, on the side that it hurt, and it doesn't hurt, and they have a capsulitis. Usually that's after they've spent $10,000 at various hospitals and other people and stuff like that. Okay? Easy. Easy. Easy, easy, easy. You got it? That's the slide, basically. So what do we do about it? Treatment, anti-inflammatories, physical therapy, use an aqualizer, hard splint. Let me go over each of those. Anti-inflammatories, here's our ibuprofen again. You could put them on a Medrol dose pack. Again, I'm not a big drug guy, so I'll put people on Medrol dose pack if they've had a good experience with steroids. So they did it for their hip or their shoulder or something, they loved it. Great. Otherwise, I don't like putting steroid virgins on steroids because they can make them do crazy stuff. Okay, crazy stuff. So, yeah, you've had that experience too? Yeah. So be careful with this on someone who's never taken a steroid before. Just put them on ibuprofen. Ibuprofen's fine. However, if I put you on a steroid or ibuprofen or whatever, orally, where's that stuff going? Everywhere. It's going to your knee and your left elbow and everywhere in your body, and you want it right here. So a good way to do this is to send them to a physical therapist, or you can do this in your office if you want. But usually you send them to a physical therapist, and they can do iontophoresis, which pushes drugs through the skin, or phonophoresis, which uses ultrasound. So iontophoresis is through this pad here. You put the medication there. And ultrasound, you'd put a coupling agent on here. It's not shown on the slide. But then they would move this head around like this, and that would treat the muscle and the joint and put the medication right where you want it. Okay? Splint therapy. Now, let's say that you've got someone, you've diagnosed a capsulitis, and you're like, you know what? I'm a really nice guy, so I'm going to take impressions right now and make a splint right now, and it's going to be balanced as you leave here. Will that feel better? Think about that. Yeah, the stick felt better. So if you put something between their teeth that's balanced, it'll feel better. However, what's our problem? What happens 2 or 3 days later when they take the splint out? They'll have an open bite on that side because you just changed where their teeth fit. You gave them a new place for their teeth to fit. For some people, no big deal, it'll kind of go back. But for a lot of people, you may then struggle for weeks to get their teeth to go back into normal occlusion. So what I like to use is a self-adjusting splint, which is this. So if this person has a capsulitis over on the left side here, let's say, and they bite down, it's going to squeeze the water out of this side and make this side fat. Okay? So this side will be high, and this side will be low, right? And then over the next few days, this will self-adjust. And after 3 or 4 days, they take it out and bites back together, doesn't hurt anymore, we're done. Okay? So it's a great thing to use. I use the Ultra. I think they still make this. I'm not sure. But I use the Ultra, and they have Mini for people with small mouths or little kids usually. We use this in little kids all the time. Huge correlation between earaches and children's bruxism. But even bigger correlation between kids' bruxing and sleep apnea. Stay tuned this afternoon for more information on that. Okay, splint therapy, once the initial capsulitis is resolved, a night guard or day splint or both may be indicated to reduce adverse joint loading. Okay, capsulitis recap. Pain in around the jaw joint, posterior open bite, pain on trying to occlude, no pain bite on a tongue blade on the affected side. Okay, this is the key. Then what are you going to do about it? Anti-inflammatories, aqualizer. That's capsulitis. That is by far the most common temporal mandibular joint disorder that you will see. It is by far the most common I see. Being referred to me by dentists. Okay? By far. Question?
How long do they wear the aqualizer?
I have them wear the aqualizer full time except meals for 3 or 4 days. Full time except meals.
I have this a year and a half ago, and now my bite has permanently changed. I'm 60 years old.
Bites off, yeah.
So now it's permanently changed.
And just started with a capsulitis.
Yeah, yep. I've opened bite on this side.
And that happens all the time, especially if it's missed, because your jaw will just change. And now that's neurologically kind of where things fit the best. So you have no... Now, theoretically, I could change that with some splint therapy. Maybe. You could too. Okay. Trismus. I thought I'd put in a stretch break, but I'm not going to give you a stretch break. So you can stand up at any time and just like wiggle around a little bit if you want. But I'm just keeping on trucking because we got about 35 minutes left. Is that right? We're out of here at 11:30, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so we're going to keep on going. Just keep him calm for a couple of days. He's got lock body. Lock body. So that's like trismus, right? So trismus, persistent contraction of the master muscle due to failure of central inhibition, often the initial manifestation of generalized tetanus. That's not what we're talking about when we as dentists talk about trismus, is it? We're not talking about tetanus. I had a patient once sent by the ER docs. And they come into my office on like a Monday and they say, hey, I went to the ER on Saturday and they said I might have tetanus and I should get in to see you. I was like, did they say you might have tetanus and you should make an appointment with Dr. Spencer and get your affairs in order? Because you're either going to be dead by Monday or you'll be seeing Dr. Spencer. Because what's the outcome of tetanus? You die. You die. You don't. Splint therapy doesn't help tetanus. Okay, so this doctor had not really given them the full deal there. So that's not what we're talking about when we're talking about trismus. We're talking about trismus as they can't open very wide, right? They have limited range, very, very, very limited range of motion. Now, this is going to happen rarely, but it's extremely important to jump on it when it does. So I will do this very quickly. Some of you, unfortunately, have had this happen to you. And so I'm going to blow through this, boom, 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 and get to the most important part, which is iatrogenic causes of trismus. And the most common one for you guys in here would be maybe third molar extraction, but most common would be direct trauma from injection into the medial pterygoid. That is the most common. So when we are giving an inferoalveolar nerve block, what muscles does our needle go through? What goes through what? Did you say none? Has to go through at least one. Buccinator and medial pterygoid. Okay, I can always, if I pull it out of you, I can get you to say medial pterygoid. So I'm lying. So buccinator is the only muscle we want it to go through. Okay, the buccinator is here. So remember at the beginning I talked about the buccinator coming together with a superior pharyngeal constrictor to form our pterygomandibular raphae. So we're going to give our shot right around in here, and that will go through the buccinator in front of the medial pterygoid, in front of it. And if we give this shot correctly, we come back here, we hit there at the lingula area, we deposit our anesthetic, and voila, mandibular block, right? Okay? Sometimes you give that shot and you just go through the mucosa there, and it's just like nothing, no resistance at all, and all of a sudden, bonk, you hit the bone. You're like, oh, there I am, and you give a shot, right? Other times you give that shot and it feels like you're pushing your needle through mud, right? You ever had that? And you're like, ooh, I'm going to have to push a little harder here. That's when you're dragging your needle through the medial pterygoid. Now, that's no problem, right? Because we sterilize the mouth before we give these shots, right? We don't? So we cover every surface in our office with plastic. We wear these gloves. We do all this stuff. And then we have a infested mouth? What the hell is that all about? So you've got a sterile needle, but you're putting it in the cesspool of the mouth. It's picking up these bugs. Then you take it back into a previously sterile spot and inoculate this area. And that can cause muscle inflammation. This is why some of your patients are very stiff and sore the day after a procedure. Stiff and soreness the day after the procedure is probably this too. That's not what I'm talking about though. You don't need to get really worried about that. What you need to get worried about is the patient that calls up a day or two later and says, Doc, I can't open. I can't get a banana between my teeth. I can barely get a spoon between my teeth. Have any of you ever had this? That's trismus. Okay? That's trismus. So what you're looking for is extreme limitation range of motion, usually under 20 millimeters. Can be 10, 11, 12 millimeters. History of that recent inferoalveolar nerve block. You do spray and stretch over the masseter, even though it has nothing to do with the masseter, but it has to do with the trigeminal nerve, and their opening will increase significantly. That's how you know that it's trismus. Okay? What do you do about it? You get them to physical therapy immediately. Immediately. Don't give them exercises to do at home. You can do that too, but give them to a physical therapist. Why? How many of you have been to a physical therapist? Do physical therapists make you do stuff that you wouldn't do to yourself? Absolutely. That is their job. Physical terrorist, they're called, right? Make you cry with your shoulder. Ah! You know, if you give someone the exercise at home, like if you had your shoulder exercises, you'd be like, I'm better. I'm good. Okay, the physical therapist makes you cry. So they're going to do the same thing on the jaw. Once they know that it's not a joint issue or something, they're going to open that patient. Okay? And that's what you have to do to get over this problem. You put them on anti-inflammatories. This, in this case, I will do a Medrol dose pack. All right? Get them in physical therapy. Okay, so remember, anytime you have severe limitation of range of motion, and it's almost always after inferiorbilar nerve block, you get them immediately to physical therapy and get them a Medrol dose pack. Questions? Okay, again, this will happen to you, maybe. This is a couple times in your career kind of thing. But here's the problem is if it happens and it gets ignored, it doesn't get better. And the longer it's ignored, that muscle won't work anymore. And I've had patients see me 4 years after their inferiorbilar nerve block. They've had their temporalis tendon cut off. They've had their masseter cut off. They've had everything else done. And none of it worked because it had nothing to do with those things. Anatomically, it had to do with the medial pterygoid, and they didn't cut that one off because it's less convenient to cut off. The other ones are easier. Okay, it sucks, and there's nothing I can do for them. Okay, one question, and I'll move on. Yes? Yeah. So you had someone with TMJ surgery, and that was different, and it may have been done maybe for the wrong thing. A lot of people with TMJ surgery, they'll end up with a disc out of place, which is my next topic here. No stretch break. All right, so internal derangements. What is that clicking? Okay, so these are the Wesselson slides. For some of you, this will be blow your mind stuff here. So this is a normal joint. This is a disc displacement. So this person, when they close down, it goes click off the disc. When they open, it goes pop into place, into place, into place. Most dentists think it's clicking out of place. All patients think it's clicking out of place. It's clicking on to the disc, not off. All patients think it's clicking off. It's dislocating. It's relocating. Okay, this is a disc out of place all the time. I'll go over each of these. So we're going to talk about reducing displacement and non-reducing displacements. So let's talk about the normal joint.
This is a normal temporomandibular joint.
Better than nothing.
The disc is biconcave and it's located in a superior position. The central thin part of the disc is consistently lying in between the condyle and tubercle. During opening, there is rotation in the lower compartment and more of translation in the upper compartment.
Okay, Dr. Wesselson is Swedish, so he said that this is the normal joint, if you didn't notice that. You can Google yoint videos, Y-O-I-N-T videos, and you will find these come up on YouTube, the yoint videos. So if we erase the soft tissue from this film, just get rid of it, what would you describe the condylar position as? Like down and forward, right? But no, this is a normal joint. Remember? So the disc, fat, skinny, fat. That disc is intimately related to the condyle. If I move the condyle back a little bit, the disc doesn't stay there. If I take it up just a little bit, it'll stay on. It wants to be there. If I bring the condyle forward and bring it back, it wants to be there. Okay? But there's all this space in the normal joint. And what's going on down here in all these videos is the teeth are together at the end. The teeth are together. All right, so let's talk about disc displacement with reduction. What the with reduction means is if I break my arm, I go to the doctor and they reduce the fracture. If I dislocate my shoulder, it gets reduced. Reduced means coming back to normal anatomical position. So in this case, the disc is out of place and then gets back to normal place. Here's the disc here. Pop
in this joint,
place.
The disc is anteriorly displaced. And it's reduced on opening with a click.
Pop into place.
These joints demonstrate reciprocal clicking, which implies clicking during opening, followed by clicking during closing. The disc is here again until it is placed.
So if I was to treat a person, I would try to make them a splint that would hold them right there. Does that look... Yeah, I kind of caught it a little late. Does that look familiar? That looks more like the normal joint, doesn't it? When I stop it there, I've got this space up here. I've got the disc in the right spot. It's the forces would be here on the articular eminence. Now, if I let this be plain...
Corresponds very well to what has been seen on arthrograms and to observations during surgery.
Stop it there. Whoops. Back up. Okay, so notice there's no space here. This disc couldn't live up on top of that condyle if it wanted to. Could it? It can't. Because what's going on down here? The teeth are in contact. The teeth fit where they fit because that's where they fit. The disc can't be there. My mentor, Nasher Mehta at Tufts University, he uses a stepping on the bar, a bar of soap analogy. Okay? The disc is the bar of soap. If we put that pressure up here, the disc has to squirt out of place. It has no choice. When we open, it pops into place. Okay? All of your patients that have clicking think it's the opposite. Many of you in this room thought it was the opposite. I've had numerous dentists tell patients, oh, your jaw clicks when you open? Just don't open so wide. Okay, do you all get that they have a 180 degree view of what's actually going on? Make sense? Okay, so now we're going to briefly talk about centric relation. That's more exciting when I have that plumbed into the sound system there, but anyway, centric relation. So how many of you graduated after 1987? Okay, this becomes more and more people the older I get. So give me some of the definitions that were used in dental school for centric relation, those of you who graduated after 1987. Yell out some terms.
Condylar position.
What?
Condylar.
Posterior superior. Give me another one.
Anterior superior.
Anterior superior. Oh. What? Superior, anterior, and medial. Others. Come on. Okay, now everybody, the whole room, can say stuff. What's some of the definitions of centric relation? What? Where the teeth first hit, okay?
Terminal hinge.
Ooh, there's a good one. I like that one. Terminal hinge.
Reproducible.
Reproducible. How about rearmost, uppermost?
Yes.
How about most retruded? Is he ringing any bells? Okay. Well, so in 1987, the Glossary of Prosthodontic Terms is why I mentioned 1987. This is the most recent definition of centric relation, 1987. Maximal mandibular relationship in which the condyles articulate with the thinnest avascular portion of the respective disc with the complex in the anterior superior position. Anterior, that's forward, against the shapes of the articular eminences. Okay, well, what about some other definitions? Okay, there's a lot of words on the screen, right? So this is the definition I just read. So this is the Glossary of Prosthodontic Terms, and this lists all the definitions that have been over time. So here's the one I just read, anterior superior. The most recent one before that was the Glossary of Prosthodontic Terms number 3, and it said the most retruded. That seemed like a big leap from most retruded to anterior. That's a huge leap. Who's kind of responsible for that? There were lots of people involved, but one guy in particular was really responsible for that. Dawson, close. So Pete Dawson had a lot to do with this, and if any of you studied with him, that manipulation is anterior, not back. But they did back for a long time, huh? I graduated in the 90s, and we were pushing people's jaws back. Okay, we're doing the tongue back, okay, eccentric. We're pushing jaws back.
We were doing it in the 70s with Peter K. Thomas and terminal hinge.
Pushing it back, right. So where's all that come from? So here, most retruded. Next one, most retruded. Most posterior. Next one, most posterior. Next one, midmost, uppermost.
Right. SSC.
Terminal axis, most superior, uppermost, and rearmost. This is a hell of a lot of pushing the jaw back for a long time. Now, here's what's really interesting, though. The oldest definition we have, number 7, a clinically determined position of the mandible placing both condyles into their anterior uppermost position. Huh. This can be determined in patients without pain or derangement in the TMJ. Weird. So Ramsford said anterior superior, and then for like 40 years, we pushed jaws back as far as we could, and then we came back to, hey, anterior superior again. Now, why did we need centric relation in the first place? Reproducibility for what? Repeatable position for what? For make dentures. Because the repeatable position for everybody else is where their teeth fit. And that's where we did dentistry in dental school, right? All of us had to do wax records, right, in dental school. And you would make like two of the three had to match, because that's pretty good, right? And then you would get with your professor and you'd say, oh, here's a slide and stuff. And you made dang sure that you went to the same professor who helped you with the records, because if you went to a different professor that didn't help you with the records, then they were wrong. Because that person had a different way of doing it. He put the tongue to the roof of the mouth. The other guy pushed it on the jaw. The other guy did whatever. So you had to go to the same professor to help you take your records. And you would do all that for PROS, and then you would do this occlusal analysis, we called it, right? And then we would put all that stuff in our locker and do the dentistry wherever they bit, laying down. Let's experiment with something really quick. Tap your teeth together looking at me. Look at the ceiling and tap your teeth together. Look at your lap and tap your teeth together. How many of you just had three different bites? Raise your hand. All of you. Okay, now just to screw with you more, look to the side and tap your teeth. And look to the other side and tap your teeth. Okay? This is why sometimes splints and occlusion and stuff changes from an assistant who tapped it in over here and the assistant who is left-handed and tapped it in over here. It's why the person gets up out of the chair and everything was fine, and by the time they get out to their car, their bite's changed. And they're all crazy. Right? Because obviously that couldn't change. Follow me? Okay, so I don't adjust people's teeth laying down, unless I plan on them using their teeth laying down. Okay, as long as they eat laying down, you got no problems. Okay, so why do I bring that all up? Because it's confusing. We were all taught these different terms, and still to this day, it's like, oh, CR, CR, CR. You know, and half of you don't even know what that means. You were taught different things. You use that term willy-nilly. You might even get religious about it, and you don't even know what it means. So I'm trying to like shed some light on this. So CR is when the disc is in place. So this next one, I'll ask you a question about CR in a second. So here's the disc here.
The next joint demonstrates anterior disc displacement without reduction, which implies that the disc is consistently lying anterior to the condyle during all mandibular movements. The disc is lying anterior to the condyle and at maximum opening the disc is folding downwards as seen here.
How would I know if someone has a disc out of place like this?
Limited opening and no clicking.
Limited opening.
No clicking.
The next joint demonstrates anterior disc displacement.
That started
without
all over
reduction,
again. That's lame.
Which implies that the disc is consistently lying anterior to the condyle.
Fast forward that. Nope. Sorry.
During all mandibular movements, the disc is lying anterior to the condyle and at maximum opening, the disc is folding downwards as seen here.
Okay, so limited range of motion.
There is a considerable stretching in the posterior disc attachment at maximum opening. And even if the disc is displaced, there can be a good range of motion.
Okay, so how can I tell someone's got this?
Due to deformation of a disc.
How can I tell? Not x-rays. An MRI. An MRI would be the only way I would know. because they could have normal range of motion. They could. They could have limited range of motion, and normally in an acute phase, it will be limited. But in a chronic person, it could be normal. No noise, that's a tough one, because then it's like, okay, everyone with no noise. I mean, but you're right, there's no clicking here. Now, by definition, can this joint be in centric relation? By definition?
Yes.
Uh-uh. Because the disc has to be properly interposed. So it can't. By definition. I'm not arguing. I'm just telling you. By definition, the disc has to be in there to be in CR, which is what Ashford or Ramsford said too. You can't have centric relation if you have an internal derangement, which is what this is. Okay? All right. So, how do we diagnose this? Based on history or imaging plus imaging. Here's your history. This is what you're looking for. Maximum opening of 26 millimeters. That's a like take it to the bank number, because that is rotation. They will deflect to the affected side. If I am locked on the right, my jaw will come to the right because it's coming down and sliding to the one side because it's stuck. It'll deflect to that side. Deviation is when the jaw goes out and comes back. That's usually with a clicking jaw. Deflection is when it goes out and stays there. Okay? They have a history of my jaw used to click. They have a history of my jaw catches occasionally, and now usually they wake up locked. Okay? Any of you ever wake up locked? Okay? One time? All right. So again, that's what you're looking for. Is the person calls up, hey, my jaw doesn't open very big. The first question I would always ask is, did your jaw used to click or is it clicking now? No, it doesn't click now, but it used to click. Okay, that's non-reducing displacement. Make sense? Okay. So this could be caused by trauma, like this guy. Or maybe microtrauma, which maybe would have something to do with like bruxism. And it's interesting how we see a lot of people with anterior wear, things like that. And again, this is for this afternoon's lecture, but this is one of my patients. Right here, 0.8 millimeters, sitting up awake in my cone beam CT machine. Do you think it's theoretically possible that when this guy goes to sleep, his jaw could fall back a whole 0.8 of a millimeter? Is that possible? And block his airway? Do you think it might be possible that his brain might choose to contract his muscles, push his jaw forward on his front teeth and stuff like that to open his airway? Maybe. Okay, again, we'll talk more about that this afternoon. But I think this is a major driver towards jaw problems. Last year, 2013, I referred roughly 300 people for sleep studies. I had three people who didn't have sleep apnea. Those were all people that came into me for TMJ problems, the 300 people. You know what that means? That means I suck at sending people for sleep studies. Because I should have sent way more. I should have way more than a 1% that don't have it. That makes sense? So there's a major correlation between these things. And if you ignore it, you're ignoring the etiology of the underlying problem. Okay, now, talking about this, back to this. So acute, 26 millimeters, deflection to the side. Chronic, you'll have a history of jaw clicking, history of reduced range of motion, usually no pain. Now, to know for sure if they've got this going on, you need an MRI. Okay, so here's an MRI. This is the side that's normal. This is the right side. Here's the disc. Here it is open. It didn't change much because they can't open that wide. Here's the disc on the left side, closed. And here it is when they open. Okay, that's a little hard to see. Here's one that's a little bit easier. So this is the normal side. Here's open. There's the disc. Right there is the disc that's out of place. And right there it is when they open. Okay? So we'll get MRIs. A little hint, if you want to get MRIs on your patient, try to find an independent MRI center that's close to you. You can get these usually for $500 or $600 cash, because a lot of TMJ problems aren't covered by medical insurance. Okay? If they go to the hospital, an MRI will cost them $2,500. If they go to an independent place, you might be able to work out a deal. I have two places in the Boise area, $600, that they'll do an MRI. They even give them payment plans. So we get MRIs every week on patients. And this makes it so I'm not guessing. This isn't I wonder if. Now, the reason that you might get one of these is, let's say you've got a patient that needs full math reconstruction, let's say, and you suspect that they might have something like this going on, maybe you would get an MRI to confirm. Now, it might not change how you treat them, but what it would do is it would allow you to inform that patient that you're about to remodel their house and their foundation has a crack in it. You might still remodel the house, but that patient needs to be informed. Okay? And that way, if 5 years down the road they have an anterior open bite because this decided to go to degenerative joint disease, it's not your problem, so to speak. You showed them what might happen. Does that make sense? So if you're going to do that, it might be a good idea to know what you're dealing with in the jaw joint, and an MRI is how you do that. Okay? Yep?
Don't they often have retrodiscitis?
Well, sure. So if this is off the disc all the time, then they are only on that retrodiscal tissue all the time. So they will often have capsulitis, and something that's very common in a chronic person is it will wax and wane. So they'll have a capsulitis that comes up and then it will go away and then it comes back again and goes away and stuff like that. So sometimes they'll be your kind of chronic TMJ patient that they have to wear a splint if it gets worn down a little, and I'm talking like 0.2 millimeter, they have to come back in and get it built up and then it works again. That's kind of the person that, and that may be how you treat them.
Can you help us read that? I'm not used to looking at MRIs. The dark is the lamina dura on the condyle.
So this is the cortical plate.
The dark. It's the opposite of the X-ray.
Yes. So the dark is the thickest bone. This is the inside. This is the outside of the bone. That's the disc.
So it's dark. So it's, I mean, it's
the disc hard. Shows up dark.
It's hard. So it's the same as the lamina dura.
MRIs have to do with water content. So the disc doesn't have a lot of water content. So bright things show up. So this is water. That's the inside of your eye. So things that, and this is air. So things that have a lot of water content show up bright, and things that don't show up dark. But it has nothing to do with hardness. Good question. Oh, and by the way, I can help you with this kind of stuff, but if you ever think that you know what's going on and you get an MRI and the report says the opposite, you need to look at the MRI yourself, because they're often wrong. Because the radiologists don't read these. Okay, just like none of you got any education on TMJ problems in dental school, they didn't get any education on TMJ problems in radiology school. So it's extremely common to have these be incorrect. And you just call up the radiologist and you say, hey, this black thing in front of the condyle, I think that's the disc. What do you think? And then they go, oh, you know what? I think you're right. Let me amend my report there. Okay? They're always usually cool about it. Okay, what do we do about this? I'm going to just in the last couple minutes here show you kind of an unlocking technique. If you want to learn how to do this, this would be some advanced training because it involves giving a shot in the jaw joint. So I just show this just more for the fun of it to kind of end the lecture here. So we're going to give a shot in the joint capsule, okay, right here. If you put your finger right in front of your ear and open, you feel that hole, that's where the needle goes. Okay, it's not brain surgery. Right there.
Hopefully.
Okay. Hopefully not brain surgery. Yes, good joke. I like that. Okay, so you palpate. I wipe off the area with alcohol or iodine. I spray this cold stuff just to make it numb. Palpate. I used to have a lot longer hair. That's with a medical syringe. Sorry for the crappy photography there. Okay, this is on my wife. I spray that. She says, Bert, that's cold. Going about an inch or until you hit the back of the condyle, which is the goal. Yep. Okay, that's it. After you give the shot, you ask the patient, does your bite feel different? It should, because you just put 1.8, 1.7 cc's of fluid in the joint. Okay, so you sort of created a capsulitis, so to speak. You filled the joint with fluid. Part of the reason that this works is because it numbs up the joint and it creates a hydraulic pressure in the joint. So as soon as they move around, it tends to pop that disc back into place. Okay? So I will just have them move around and I leave because they're usually kind of freaked out, right? Because I'm going to stick a needle in the side of their head. By the way, that's how you sell the MRI. You say, I'd like to get an MRI so I know for sure what's going on before I stick a needle in the side of your head. Or I could just stick the needle inside your head, but it may not be necessary. The patient's like, let's get the MRI. Okay? So I get the MRI. We know what's going on. I stick the needle in. And then I leave, and I say, just move your jaw around while I'm gone. Most of the people, 50 to 70% of the time, they'll pop back on the disc while I'm out of the room after I've given the shot. okay, because I've just lubed it up.
What kind of fluid are you putting?
Anesthetic. Yeah, I use carbocaine. Carbocaine for this. Okay, or we can do some manipulation. I'd pull their jaw this way if they were stuck on this side. I would push their jaw that way if they were stuck on this side. Or I would crank them open this way. Okay, or you can do the dental school technique, so to speak. What if they don't unlock? Well, dental school answers. You know, if you tried to do something in dental school and it didn't work out very well, the typical comment was, well, it's because you suck as a dentist. And your margin is open, just to add insult to injury. Okay. That's how my dental school was anyway. Real answers, sometimes they don't unlock and sometimes they aren't locked in the first place. So sometimes your diagnosis is wrong, especially if you didn't get the MRI. Okay? Next step, we do some other stuff. So you have to make something, a splint, if you get them unlocked, you must put something in your mouth immediately, because otherwise, if they were off the disc, you got them back on the disc, and now you just let them go, what happens when they're in the car? Their teeth go back together and the disc pops out of place again. So you have to fit them immediately with a temporary splint. Okay? And so this is one that I make. I decided to name this after myself because in the TMJ field, everybody names stuff after themselves. So this is called the Spencer Bilaterally Indexed Nathological Early Guidance Orthotic. But that's a lot. So you just use the acronym, which is the Spencer Big Ego, which is cool. Seriously, though, you need to use something like this. And I'll show you just as a film here, basically, how to make it. So you take this thermoplastic beads, and you warm it up. And you put it into a horseshoe. And you stick it on the teeth. And then she bites down exactly where I want her to, which is where the disc is in place. Okay, now I trim this up. I teach how to do this through the AACP Institute and Tufts. Warm it up, smooth it out. My staff do this now. They've been taught how to do this. They can do this in about 5 minutes. And that's it. What about arthrocentesis? So a lot of people, these problems get sent for arthrocentesis, don't they? Well, the literature says that about 10% of joints became disc displacement with reduction after the surgery. 10% is all. So 90% of the time it didn't work. Well, here's what I think happened. I don't believe that. I think what happens is the vast majority of the time when they do the surgery, flushing the jaw joint out, I bet they get the person back on the disc. But when the person's in recovery, they go back off the disc. Because, any surgeons in the room? Yeah, do you fit a splint after doing arthrocentesis? Were you taught to do that? No. Okay, so when I do arthrocentesis with my surgeons, I go and I make a splint. And the surgeon does his thing, almost always gets them on the disc, because the person's sedated, and we're like, crank, and we get them on the disc. And then we put the splint in right then. And then it's effective.
Okay?
And they wear it full time eating and everything for at least a week. That's another study. That keeps the disc on. And then we have to go from there. Okay, so here's our recap slides. The whole deal in one slide. Capsulitis, remember your tongue blade test, Aqualizer, and Advil. Okay? Does that make sense? Those two lines, that make sense with everybody? Just a second. I'll take your question at the end. Trismus, remember severely reduced range of motion after an inferior alveolar nerve block. Medrol dose pack, physical therapy. Okay? Last one, non-reducing displacement. Remember, 26 millimeters range of motion. They don't click, but they used to. And what are you going to do? You're probably going to refer them as quick as you can to somebody who knows what they're doing. Okay? These two you can handle totally by yourself. This one you might need to learn a little bit more to handle by yourself. Okay, here's my email address, jamesonrspencer@gmail.com. My website is jamesonspencer.com. Here's some other things on there that you can look at to learn more. Thank you so much for your time today. Hope you enjoyed it. I don't know if I made TMJ easy, but hopefully made it a little easier. Thank you.